and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here, as always, to talk about stuff this week on the show. You might, if you listened last week, you might have heard us say, we're not sure what we're going to talk about next week.
I believe that is basically how we ended our podcast.
And we're like, we'll figure it out off the air. I think we were even thinking, maybe we had not taken an off week in forever. Maybe there would be an off week or something, because there just wasn't a lot going on. We were catching up with other things. You've been playing Persona 5,
yeah,
which you can only talk about limitedly right now.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And then the week got crazy, because Red Dead Redemption 2 was announced, and a bunch of movie trailers came out, and Nintendo just decided, hey, tomorrow we're going to announce our new console. You guys cool with that? And we're like, okay, Nintendo, that was kind of out of the blue.
Yeah.
Just a crazy week. We've got so much news on the outline. We haven't had like a news-heavy show in a while. We do kind of enjoy doing those because they're fun.
Yeah.
But it's just been weird.
Yeah,
so.
It's just so rare for so much to be piled up on one day that like... I'm glad that we didn't do anything else. We didn't see, like, a new movie in the theater or something, because there's no room to talk about anything other than all the fucking news that happened past week.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. So, let's start with a couple pieces of stuff.
Okay.
Because I think I have a couple games to talk about, but I never do this. I want to talk about music for a second.
Okay.
Because this weekend, a documentary aired on PBS about the musical Hamilton.
Right.
Which is, like, this huge phenomenon, yeah. Right? And somehow I had gone this, like, 2 years of the Hamilton phenomenon and never actually sat down and listened to it. Like, I heard some songs here and there.
Right.
But I was like, okay, I had a kind of a dry Saturday night. And so I was like, I should listen to some of this. And I got Apple Music a couple months ago, so I've been able to listen to a lot more music than I would otherwise.
Uh-huh.
So I got the Hamilton soundtrack, and I was like, I just want to kind of try this out. And it's a, like, 2.5 hour soundtrack, because I think the musical is just sung through. I don't think there's, like, dialogue parts.
Right.
And I basically just sat there and listened to the whole thing. And I felt like I needed to talk about it, because I know I'm the last person in America to praise Hamilton.
Right.
But oh my God.
Is it good?
Oh my God.
Yeah,
it's good.
Haven't, like, I want to watch it at some point, so I haven't, like, listened to any of it.
Well, that's the first thing I will say. It works perfectly as an album.
Okay.
And in fact, when it was originally conceived, Lin-Manuel Miranda, it was called, the writer of it was calling it the Hamilton mixtape. And it wasn't necessarily intended to be a play.
Okay.
So I think it works. It would be cool to see it, definitely.
Yeah.
None of us are going to see it live anytime
soon.
Yeah,
obviously. Like, that's when they released the fucking DVD version of it or whatever.
Right. I believe, like, it sold out on Broadway to December of 2017.
Yeah.
Which is just crazy. But no, that was one thing that really impressed me, was you can definitely follow it as an album. It works very well. But oh my God, it's... Without a doubt, like, I don't have to parse this in any way. It is the best musical I've ever heard.
Okay,
like,
sure.
Nothing else even comes remotely close, especially if we're talking about stage musicals or, like, movie musicals, where we're not talking about, like, weird things like All That Jazz, which is the Bob Fosse movie that's kind of a musical but kind of not.
Right.
Something like that. You know, Hamilton mixes a lot of different musical styles, primarily sort of rap and R&B stuff. And it is just so good. It is so invigorating. It is so musically intelligent, down to the way it spends all this time, you know, introducing musical themes and ideas and repeating them in a way that builds and builds in kind of emotional impact until you get to the end of the play, which is crazy in terms of how hard it hits you. And I think the other thing that hit me about it is just the political atmosphere we're in right now. And we don't talk about politics too much on this show.
Yeah.
I think it's okay to talk about them a little bit more this year.
Friendly. Yeah, when things are so extreme that there's, like, one person that is Neo-Hitler.
Yes.
And the other person that is a reasonable candidate. I feel like it's like, okay, well, yeah, you can kind of say, hey, fuck fascism.
Right, and for instance, I mean, I don't think we talked about politics at all in 2012. We were doing the show, and when it was Romney, Obama, it's like, you and I were both for Obama, but it's like, if Romney was president, it's not the end of the world.
No.
You know?
Trump's president,
it could be
very likely could be the end of the world.
Yeah. Anyway. But I think, just taking a step back from that, I think some of the comments Trump has made and things that have happened in the media have had us thinking a lot about the fundamentals of what American democracy is in a way we have not had to in any election, certainly of our lifetimes.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the things Trump says make you question the things we take for granted, like the peaceful transfer of power.
Yeah.
And the sanctity of voting and all these basic things. And that gets you thinking about American history and the start of this country. And for me, I've had a weird effect with this election where I'm strangely feeling more patriotic in some ways. Where it's just like, okay, even if it all falls apart this year, we had a good streak.
Sure,
we went like 250 years on one constitution from the 1700s that these guys came together and built, and they made a nation that lasted at least this long. And we've had our troubles. We've done our bad things.
Sure, yeah, we've done a lot of bad things, that's for sure.
But, I mean, certainly compared to other democracies and things in the world, it's like, it's pretty fucking impressive. And I think that's one of the things that struck me about Hamilton is how much of a celebration it is of what the Founding Fathers and the birth of America, how impressive a feat that is if you really take a step back and don't take it for granted.
Right.
That it had to be not one person, but this collection of people with often very different ideas who could fight, who could kill each other in duels, which is what happens to Alexander Hamilton in his duel with Aaron Burr. But that if you had even kind of like one of those people wouldn't have been there, the American experiment might not have worked, because it was this, it's just such a weird historical phenomenon. And I think Hamilton, while it is about Alexander Hamilton, like most stories of the Founding Fathers, it winds up kind of being about all of them in some way.
Yeah.
You know, there's this wonderful musical number in the second act that happens where George Washington is telling Alexander Hamilton, who's basically his right-hand man, that he's going to be stepping down and he's not going to run for a third term. Which, if you don't know, you know, that set the precedent for presidents only doing two terms until that was made, ratified in the 22nd Amendment 200 years later.
Yeah.
And it does such a good job of kind of taking you back to that moment and realizing that, again, that's not something you can take for granted, because George Washington so easily could have just ruled for however long he wanted. He was so beloved. But he realized the health of the country was so much more important than that.
Yeah.
And just moments like that, that Hamilton, without being didactic, without being kind of, you know, empty in its patriotism, because it is critical of these men, and it has a lot of fun with it, like it does the cabinet battles as rap battles, like throwdowns. Freestyles. And that's just amazing to have Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton doing like a freestyle throwdown over the role of a centralized bank in America.
Sure, yeah.
And it's almost like the Schoolhouse Rock effect of that, it's such a fun way of learning about history that you want to learn about so much more history. But I was just getting back to that Washington moment of, again, it's hard to, you know, take away the kind of historical portraiture that we have of this era. And that's, to me, the most impressive thing about that musical, is that it makes it of the moment and immediate, and makes you think about these historical issues in a way that I think are really important for the United States at this junction, because Trump's probably going to lose. We can say that pretty easily. But
if my vote counts, then yeah.
Yes. But the effect is not going to die with him. Of what happened this election. You know, it's not... Things aren't going to be reset on November 9th.
Fascism doesn't just go away. Like,
yeah.
It didn't just go away in the 40s.
Right. So these are things to think about. And so Hamilton, I think part of it is, it is just such powerful music, and I don't know the last time new music that I hadn't heard before hit me this fucking hard. But, like, I think especially in this atmosphere, I was just kind of primed for that.
Right.
And I think it's good to take a step back and be like, yeah, we went through a lot to get to where we are. Let's not throw it away on a reality television star.
Exactly, yeah.
Is that a good way to say it?
Yeah, yeah. Like, that, like you saying that, it makes me think of, because this also came up in one of the debates in a really weird way, is the Spielberg movie Lincoln. That,
yes.
Like, that has that similar quality of, like, looking back at this seminal moment in American history and sort of not taking it for granted. And that was my favorite part about that movie, was, like, because we just live in this world where it's like, well, of course the North won the Civil War, and of course Lincoln was able to, like, pass what he needed to pass and, like to emancipate the slaves and everything like that. But we just live in a history where that happened, and going back to that moment and analyzing, like, how did that happen and what did this guy have to do to make that work?
And how nearly it didn't
happen.
Yeah,
and how it so easily could have gone another way, and that in that moment, like, it's so hard to see, like, which way the future is going to go. Like, that's so fascinating to me. That's cool that Hamilton does that as well.
Absolutely. And Hamilton, of course, stylistically is very different, but I think that's probably the best comparison I have in, like, this decade would be, like, Spielberg's Lincoln, in that it's a piece of history and historical dramatization that feels vibrant and not stoic and not building a statue, but really trying to breathe life back into something that is literally statues for us, you know? I started reading today because it was on for, this was such a weird bit of coincidence, but this morning Amazon put on sale the George Washington biography from the same author who wrote the Hamilton biography that Hamilton the play is based on.
Okay.
And so I started reading that this morning on my Kindle, and he kind of, in his prelude, the author talks about that, of like, we know George Washington literally as a statue. you know, or as the Washington Monument. And that doesn't...
Or as the state.
Yeah, or as the state. And that really doesn't do any service to our understanding of history.
Yeah.
And why history is important. So anyway, it was almost like a religious awakening experience hearing this musical. And yeah, I would love maybe in the 2030s sometime to see Hamilton on stage.
Yeah.
If I can get tickets by then.
In the year 2120, you can finally see the hologram performance of Hamilton with Hatsune Miku playing the lead role.
I really wish they would just put out a DVD of Broadway performances, because I guess the theory is that it would depress turnout in some way and people wouldn't want to go see the show. I kind of doubt that would be the case.
Yeah, and I feel like you'd make so... Because your audience for a DVD release is so much bigger than for people who are going to see it live.
And I don't know. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. If it's a show I really love, whether or not I've seen it on DVD, I'd still like to see it live.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's a different experience.
Yeah, it's not like people who fucking buy CDs of bands they like don't go to the live shows. Because, well, why would I go to the live show? I have a CD I could just listen. I mean, that's my thing I do because I don't like being in crowds. But most people who go to live shows buy the DVD or buy the CD and then go to the live show after they get the CD and become a fan of the band.
Yes, exactly. All right. Well, anyway, I just thought that would be a little something different to start the show with.
Sure.
Kind of a fun topic. So again, you don't need me to recommend it to you.
Yeah, no.
But Hamilton's really good. You know what else is really good?
Persona 5 is really good.
Persona 5 is really good. Do you want to say anything about Persona 5?
It's still really good. There's nothing. Do you have any further questions to ask me? I feel like I'm so deep into the game. I have no perspective on what I can say anymore.
Right.
So all I can do is answer questions.
I mean, we're going to talk about Persona 5 a little later because there was a trailer for the English dub, and I do have some questions there, certainly. I mean, we were talking off the air. You're pretty near the end.
Yeah, I'm judging by the trophies, which is the only thing I really have to go off of. I'm in the second to last dungeon. I have hit the point in the game where, like, they've basically suggested for me where probably the end date for Social Link stuff is, or cooperation events, which is what they're called in the Japanese version. And so I took out the calendar in the game and, like, have plotted out. And I think, unless it throws me a couple of curveballs, I should be able to get all the Social Links maxed out by the end of the game.
That would be pretty impressive.
Yeah, which is... It was very stressful playing the game this way, like compared to Persona 4 The Golden, where I basically knew everything except for the added stuff. Here it was like, I have no idea when this game's over. I have no idea if they're going to throw another Social Link. Like, they threw me a Social Link I was not expecting to, like, kind of late in the game, that I had to be like, okay, shit, now I have to, like, scratch everything up and come up with my fucking schedule again to fix this.
Well, here's just a general question.
Okay.
We said, you know, we love the Social Links in all the games. They're the heart of these games.
Yeah.
We said, generally, the average quality of the Social Links is probably better in Persona 4 than in Persona 3.
Yeah.
Where do you put them for Persona 5?
I would say they're probably about where Persona 4 is. Like, it's interesting because there's sort of a... Obviously, like, Persona 3, Persona 4, and Persona 5, all of them have, like, this really different stylistic difference at their core in terms of the themes they're trying to approach and what... And so all the Social Links tend to revolve around that. So, like, in Persona 3, you have a lot of Social Links that are about kind of, like, death and stuff. And particularly, you have the one of the kid who's the, like, terminal patient who spends his, like, Sunday afternoons at the park and stuff like that. And so those have those kind of Social Links. So a lot of the Persona 3 Social Links ended up being kind of, like, weird and grim in a dark way. And the Persona 4 ones are a lot more about, like, helping people discover something about themselves. And then Persona 5, so much of the Persona 5 stuff sort of thematically is about... It's this very sort of, like, punk rock thing of sort of getting up, like the main theme is called Wake Up, Get Up, Get Out There. And that's sort of like what the game is about. It's about sort of like awakening to your potential and realizing, like, I don't have to, like, be oppressed by these people. Like, if there's some injustice in the world, I should stand up to that. And I should go out there and make a difference and be different and stuff like that. And so the Social Links revolve around that a lot. And so it's hard for me to say, like, qualitatively, I would say maybe they're, like, on the same level as Persona 4, but stylistically, a lot of the stuff they deal with feels so different in terms of the themes that's kind of hard to compare them at some point.
But they're good.
Yeah, they're very good. And they do some fun stuff with the Social Links in terms of they'll, like, different, like, what kinds of Social Links and, like, how you advance them sometimes will be interesting, or, like, the kinds of things they can do during Social Links will be a bit different than stuff you've seen before.
Awesome.
But yeah, I like the Social Links a lot. And if you are someone who... This is a sort of a weird aspect of some of the Social Links. if you are someone who is into slightly older women, like, there are a lot of, like, 20-something women in this game that you get social links with. And if you're wondering if you can do the romantic relationship thing that you could in Persona 3 and 4, yeah, you can.
That is my type.
And you are so, still playing a 16, 17-year-old high school kid.
Slightly weirder, but I can go with that.
But there's something about the game with the it makes it work in a way that's really surprising.
I can see that. Yeah. And you said that, and I'm not really joking. That is sort of my type too. So it's like, it's a thing, like I can put myself back in the shoes of when I was 16 or 17 and see how that, yes, I can see how that would work.
Yeah, so. But there are several, which is like that's the thing funny. That's really interesting about it. I think it's sort of using that intentionally, but it's interesting.
Awesome. Well, we will talk about this more
in
time to come.
Yeah, I should probably, unless, like, fucking who knows. This game has surprised me in so many insane ways along the way. I have no idea, but I feel like I should probably have finished Persona 5 by the next podcast.
Okay.
If I haven't, I don't know what I'm going to do with the rest of my life, because, like, I've spent so much time playing this game already.
I think we should do, like, a podcast post-show next week, where you do, like, 20 minutes reviewing the game, full spoilers, but in Japanese. And so anyone who can speak Japanese can listen to that part of the podcast.
Sure, it'll take me like a week to prepare it and write it up, but...
I'm just joking. But that would be kind of fun, because that would be a great way to get around. It's like, there's spoilers here, but most of you won't understand it.
Yeah.
You'll be able to hear, like, Morgana, and things like that.
Morgana. Yeah. Morgana, fucking awesome. That character is amazing.
Also my favorite voice in the new the English trailer.
Yeah.
I liked that. Anyway, so we will...
In Japanese, Morgana, voiced by the woman that voices Pikachu.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That seems weirdly perfect, actually.
Yeah, it's like, obviously it's a completely different performance, but I was looking up some of the cast because there's another character that is voiced by a very famous Japanese voice actor that's very famous for a particular role. But when I was looking that up, I was like, oh, wait, I kind of recognize that. Is that the woman that is totally the voice of Pikachu? What the fuck?
That's awesome. I mean, she must be... I mean, I'm sure she does lots of different voice work, but she's got to be happy to be in a new, like, hit game, because this is a huge hit, and it's going to be a hit around the world, where she gets to say more than, Pikachu!
Yeah, but somehow she's weirdly typecast as animals in video games. It's like her biggest breakout role.
I mean, she's the most famous animal in the history of video games.
It's true.
So, yeah. So maybe the most recognizable voice other than Mario.
Yeah.
Or something. So, yeah. All right. Well, cool. Let's go ahead and move on. Speaking of Nintendo, I have one Nintendo game, and Pokemon in particular. There was a Pokemon Sun and Moon demo.
Right. Yeah. How was that?
It's really good, and it's very much in line with other 3DS demos from the last few years, where the 3DS has kind of brought back this idea of the demo not as this sort of just lazy, here's the first 30 minutes, but, like, let's do a unique sort of chunk of an experience that gives you a flavor for our game, but doesn't really overlap with the main game itself. Both of the Bravely Default games did this. Pokemon Omega Ruby Alpha Sapphire did this. There's been several of these. And so 3DS demos tend to be kind of fun to dive into for that reason. And Sun and Moon is no exception. It basically gives you this little 30-minute chunk to play. I'm not sure where you are situated sort of in the overall game, but you have a Greninja that's like level 30, and it gives you a really good flavor for what the game looks like, feels like. You get to see a lot of Pokemon, you get to hear a lot of the music, which is really cool. The music in this game is great, the graphics are fantastic, really just beautiful art direction, which I think we kind of knew from the trailers and stuff.
Right.
Having this Hawaii setting, I think, serves the game very well. But also they get to show off some of the big changes, and I was not... I thought this game looked really cool. I didn't know they were kind of going as radical as they are in some ways with Pokemon Orthodoxy, or whatever you want to call it. There are no gyms in Pokemon Sun and Moon.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Which is kind of cool. And you get to do one of the gym replacements, which is called a trial. And I don't know if this trial is going to be in the game itself, or if this is a demo-only thing. If I'm not mistaken, I think the one for Ruby and Sapphire, maybe it came up later in the game, but at least with what I played, I think it was kind of its own unique thing. And this might be too, but the trial was kind of neat. Like, basically you have to go through this cave and look for this particular kind of Pokemon and do a couple of battles, but also these other special things, and then you get to clear the trial, and I guess that's how they kind of have replaced gym badges in terms of progression.
Right.
So the game feels a little more exploration-based than maybe, you know, these kind of boss battle-based things. And I kind of like that. I think that's maybe cool. Where the strengths of Pokemon lie to me. So, anyway, that's neat. I liked the new Pokemon that I saw. Like, they definitely seemed pretty cool. Like, the ones that are in the demo are pretty much you know, here's your Rattata replacement. Here's
your Pidgey.
Yeah, that kind of those. But they look cool, and they're probably better Pokemon designs than I think we've had in a couple generations. But definitely this, from what I played, continues the upward trajectory from Pokemon X and Y, which I thought was a great Pokemon game, easily the best since the Game Boy generations. And, you know, I think this seems even better. I've loved everything we've seen in the trailers. I like how just weird they're going with it, where we keep seeing things from, like, the Pokedex, like, they have Alola versions of different Pokemon.
Right.
And that's just kind of a fun idea, I think, to kind of rework old Pokemon in addition to having new ones.
Yeah, instead of having to just be like, okay, we have to make another, like, 500 of these fucking things. Like, let's, you know, generation remix. Let's go back to the past. Let's say, instead of just making five new Rattatas, let's just take Rattata and, like, give him a different hairstyle.
Exactly. Nope. And they've done some of that. The new Pokemon are cool. It just seems very good. The music, I have to give a shout-out to. It reminded me strongly of, like, kind of other Japanese games right now, like Digimon Story or even the Persona games, of this kind of just fun rock kind of aesthetic to the music where it's playing with different styles. And it's more distinctive than Pokemon music has kind of ever been. There's some really interesting just tracks from that demo. And then the battle music is kind of just standard battle, although I think it's a good version of it.
Sure.
But some of the stuff when I was just walking around, I was kind of struck by, this does not sound like kind of typical Pokemon music. So I liked that. I liked the graphics a lot. Apparently this game does not use 3D at all, which is kind of interesting to me.
Oh, like it doesn't even turn on?
No.
Huh.
You know what? There was one thing that used 3D, and that's, there's this little part where you're using, you kind of have to take a... Oh, yeah, the trial was it's like Pokemon Snap-esque. You had to go take pictures of Pokemon.
Okay.
Which is always fun.
That is the right thing to do with Pokemon.
And that was the only part that had 3D in the demo, was when you were taking a picture, you could kind of use the gyroscope to move around. You could also just use the circle pad.
Right.
But in that view, there was 3D. But other than that, like, X and Y had no 3D except for battles and other special animations. Like, some of the gym animations might have 3D. But the problem was X and Y, like, the 3D would kill the frame rate.
Right.
So I never really used it. Like, clearly these Pokemon games are kind of taxing the 3DS, which you wouldn't... Pokemon has not traditionally been graphically all that taxing, but they've kind of pushed it more with the 3DS generation, which is neat. But yeah, so the battles do not have any 3D this time. So it seems like they've really decided kind of to maximize the graphics, kind of without worrying about the 3D.
Right.
And I have also heard, I was reading about this on Reddit, some people were saying that it doesn't run as well on the standard 3DS, because I have a new 3DS.
Right.
But if you're running it on, like, a 2DS or the old standard 3DS, there's, I guess, just some loading times and things like that it doesn't run as well.
Huh.
So just, you know that. If you like your 3DS, I can definitely recommend upgrading to a new 3DS. It's very good. But yeah, that's a little too bad for people who have not upgraded yet. But I'm also kind of, on the flip side, glad that it does seem like it's making use of some of the graphical power in the new 3DS.
Right.
But yeah, this is part of the ongoing discussion that we're also going to start having with, like, the PS4 Pro and the Xbox Scorpio of, like, split generations and what the hell you do with games that need more power than the old version can really provide. It's weird.
Yeah.
Probably more stark on the 3DS because it's so small to begin with. But anyway, no, I like the Pokemon Sun and Moon demo a lot. I'm very excited for that game. Like, I was saying this to my brother the other day. I don't think I've been this excited for a Pokemon game since I was, like, a kid and maybe Ruby and Sapphire or Diamond and Pearl were coming out. And it just, I think, comes from having a really strong Pokemon game last time that was a big surprise for me, and then having a lot of good marketing and interesting directional stuff for the new one. So, yeah,
cool.
So that's fun. I would recommend that demo. It's free. Also, you get to keep the Greninja in the full game. So, and it's a special Greninja. So,
well, yeah, I mean, but it's still a Greninja, though.
Greninja's cool.
Yeah.
I like Greninja.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Give me a fucking Ivysaur, either. I'll be happy.
That's the grass Pokemon. We're talking about a water Pokemon.
The frogs are amphibian. Okay. So.
All right.
They are water and grass.
I want to talk about
they're doing the job right.
I want to talk about one other game I've been playing that has been eating up an unhealthy amount of my time.
Okay.
Which is Gears of War 4 Horde Mode.
Okay.
So last week I reviewed the campaign of Gears of War 4. I always just want to call
it... If this is a safe space, Jonathan, okay, we can call the game the way it should have been titled.
Called Gears of 4.
Yes.
Yes, anyway...
Actually, it should be Gears O apostrophe 4.
Gears of 4.
Gears of 4.
Indeed. But anyway, I talked about the campaign and I said, it's okay, not great. And I've already kind of forgotten it, so whatever.
Yeah, there's something about they weren't any locusts, but then there were locusts. That's what I remember.
Pretty much. And Marcus isn't supposed to be the main character, but really he is.
Ah, come on.
Anyway, so, and yeah, they killed the one other female character so they could have a new female character.
Right, yeah.
Anyway.
Anya's in heaven in a better video game.
Well, anyway, I can tell you, this is such a stark difference. The campaign is kind of boring to me in Gears of War 4. Horde mode is fantastic. And it is so good that I kind of think maybe they should just stop making campaign and competitive multiplayer and just make Gears of War like a horde mode that you buy, and it's maybe like $30 instead of $60.
Right.
But it's like, you know, kind of Overwatch or something where it's just the multiplayer and you do something with that, because it's so clearly not just where the heart of the game lies, but where I feel like the heart of the developers lie too. Like, because Horde is just the best thing about Gears of War. I feel
it,
like that's...
It has been since 2, when they introduced Horde mode.
There's a reason we call every other, like, you know, wave of enemy activity type Horde.
Yeah, because, not just, like, survival game types,
yeah,
because, which is what they are.
Because Horde always has done it best, and Gears of War 4 takes that crown proudly back, and it's really, really good. And it's also an area where they've clearly innovated more than in the other parts of the game. I should say I haven't played, like, the competitive multiplayer all that much yet, like Deathmatch and stuff. And mostly that's because it's a fucking mess on a network level. It takes forever to get into games.
I've read some stuff that it's hard to find matches on the PC version, which seems weird.
Huh. And I haven't played it.
Because that's like the one place in competitive multiplayer where it doesn't do crossplay for obvious reasons, because it's like mouse and keyboard stuff. But
yeah. That's weird. I mean, it's hard. You can find matches on the console, but they're very underpopulated, and like it doesn't do a good job of like evening out teams. So I've had games where I'm 5-on-3, which makes no sense.
Yeah,
you can fix that.
Yeah, that's actually like Gears of War 2 when it launched had a lot of those kinds of issues, which was one of the reasons why I never got into Gears 2 multiplayer much.
Yeah, it seems like it's good. You know, it's the only part of the game that on Xbox runs at 60 frames per second. It looks nice. The maps seem really cool. And I had one match that was pretty even and was fun to play, but otherwise it's just been like 5-on-3 and we just get killed a bunch and I can't do anything. And it's like, this is not fun.
Yeah.
So, but Horde mode, luckily a little more even, and Horde is so good. And like I said, it's an area where I feel like they've innovated more. Again, the gameplay foundation is Gears of War 3. It looks and feels and plays the same, but they've done a lot of smart stuff to, I think, make Horde more kind of addictive, but also playable than ever before. Like, they have sort of this process where every 10 waves, the game kind of resets, and it adds a new, almost like a skull in Halo, but they're standardized. Right. So for the waves 11 through 20, you have, the enemies have double health. And then for the next 10 waves, it's double health plus they have double accuracy. Then the next 10 waves are they have double health plus double accuracy plus you have half health.
Yeah, that's kind of like what ODST Firefight was, where like they had their skulls that would like stack on top of the further you got in.
And it's good for a couple of reasons, because also, if I'm remembering correctly, Gears 2 and 3, their horde just got harder with every wave.
I don't think they added modifiers. It's been so long since I played, I don't remember. But I think there was like a thing where it's like you did 10 waves, and at the 10th wave it was like a boss. And then like the kinds of enemies sort of reset a bit. Like it would be like a step up from what wave 1 was when you're at wave 11. But it would go back to sort of like normal enemies. And then it would slowly build up to be like... And then now there's like a fucking Brumac on the map or whatever.
Then maybe it's not as different as I was remembering. But I just remember Gears of War 3 Horde being maybe a little more difficult and breathless early on. But I do feel like whatever changes they've made, it makes it a little more better paced. Where it does that same thing you're describing. Where wave 11 is kind of a new version of wave 1. But with just a little more difficult to kind of get you back into it. But it has this great almost like kind of accordion form where it kind of goes out and out and gets harder and harder. And then it comes back in and you breathe for a little bit and then it goes out and out. But it's just very well paced. It's very playable. The whole thing of the fabricator mechanic that they've added where you have your fabricator which makes all the stuff and you can kind of move it around the map. It's also a thing in campaign. That's really cool and how that works.
So and then is also that like the fortification kind of stuff that they had in Gears 3?
Okay. Yeah. And you can make your, you know, caltrops and your turrets and weapon lockers and things like that. So it's more fleshed out than like Gears 3 had with its fortification stuff. But also there's a class system. So there are 5 classes in Horde now, and I wasn't sure how I felt about it initially, but I think it's kind of the masterstroke of this Horde, because the 5 classes are, there's Soldier, which is basic, where you have your Lancer and your Gnasher and your grenades, and you can go to town and you're out there killing, right?
Yeah.
That's Soldier. There's also Sniper, so that's a Sniper class. They stay back a little, they have the Sniper Rifle, that sort of thing. There's a Heavy class, and they have more heavy weapons to do, obviously, heavy damage. And so those are sort of the three combat classes. And then there's a class called Scout, which can do damage, and they, I think they have like a Retro Lancer and a Gnasher or something. But what Scouts do that's special is when you kill enemies, they drop energy that is used to fuel the Fabricator, which allows you to make stuff. And if Scouts grab the energy, they get double the energy than if someone else, like a soldier, grabs the energy.
Right.
So Scouts are supposed to be kind of out on the map. They're a little faster getting energy and stuff and bringing it back. And then the final class is Engineer, and anyone can technically build from the Fabricator. And actually, I'll talk about this later. I think it's a mistake that they allowed them to do that. But anyone can technically build. But if a Engineer builds, what they build has like extra health and stuff. And then they can also repair the fortifications. They can reload the turrets, things like that. They can also fight, but their primary function is fortification and planning and building.
Right.
And so when you have a team that is balanced and is using those five classes and everyone knows their roles, it's really fun because you can just kind of go to town doing one thing well, and if you can trust your teammates to do their thing well, then you can be a little more specialized. Whereas I do kind of remember a Horde being a little too chaotic sometimes, maybe in old versions, because you didn't have that kind of built-in specialization.
Right.
But you have it now, and it's really smart. So I've primarily played as a soldier and an engineer, and I like both of those roles a lot. My brother has been playing as a sniper and a scout, so we've gotten a pretty good feeling for all of the classes. And, you know, when you have a good game going, you'll have, you know, maybe I'm the soldier and I'm out there getting a lot of kills, and someone will be the scout like Thomas, and they'll be really focusing on getting all that energy and bringing it back. And because we have lots of energy, then the engineer can be building a lot of stuff in the fabricator and making sure we're well fortified so that when the tough stuff comes, it's more manageable. And then that fortification keeps kind of growing because the fabricator gets subsequent levels the more you do with it, and so you have better traps and you have better turrets and all that stuff. And just the way it kind of builds is so well done and so well paced and engaging on that just basic gameplay level. So I really like that. And Thomas and I have basically been playing this for like 2 hours every night all week, because nice. Horde is not something you can play for like 15 minutes at a time. It's long.
Yeah. Like you said, it's that sense of pacing that they have that it's just like, it gets tougher and tougher and tougher, and then you tough it out, and then like that sort of snap back where like the tension levels out and you're like, ow, I feel so powerful. I feel so strong, because it's like, you know, like the training weights have come off or something, and now like I'm just like, it's really weak enemy, so you can just kill everything. You're like, oh, I can do a couple more waves like this.
Yeah.
And then it starts getting harder. You're like, okay, I can't give up now just because it's getting harder. I'm not a wussy.
Right. And, you know, the best way to play Horde obviously would be if you had like a clan and five people and you could talk to them and you knew them on some level.
Yeah.
But I don't have that. You know, I don't have like a gaming group really I play with. I think most people don't,
yeah.
Obviously. But luckily it does have matchmaking and it'll give you a team of five. And sometimes people are dicks and drop out early. And the only thing is I do wish it would repopulate. It does not do that. It doesn't make sense. I wish it would do that, because sometimes you'll be at like wave 30, two people will drop out, and then it's like, well, we were on a roll, we could keep going, but with three people, there's just not much you can do once you're in the high waves, and I just wish it would repopulate.
Yeah.
Because I'd be okay jumping in at like a wave 30, just knowing that, okay, this is not going to be like a 2 hour match, but I'll get my experience, I'll get to help this team out, and it'll be fun.
Yeah.
Anyway, they don't do that, and that's kind of annoying. But you can still, in matchmaking, sometimes games can be bad depending on your team, but overall, it is still perfectly playable. You're probably not going to necessarily get to wave 50, but I will say, Thomas and I had an experience where we had a team of five just randomly matchmade, and we got to wave 37. And that's pretty good. So we got really far, and then kind of it fell apart for a number of reasons. It gets hard, obviously, the further you go.
Yeah, if you don't have a lot of communication, at least in like the old Horde modes, you will get wiped out.
Well, and the good thing, I think, the other good thing that the class system adds is that if people know what they're doing, the class system adds in, I think, some built-in communication.
Right,
because you just know, the engineer should do this. So I'm going to let them do their job, I'll do my job. And I think I definitely think in matchmaking it is easier than it was in Gears 3, because that class system makes it clear what people are supposed to do.
Yeah, although then you get the situation of, like, in MMOs or class-based like team shooters and stuff, where people are just like, hey, play your fucking class, you idiot! What are you doing? Why, you're a sniper, what are you doing over there, you fucking idiot? Play your class!
There is a little of that. There's also, like, we got some, level 1 newbies the other night, and I was the engineer, and they did not know what any of the classes were, clearly, so they just started building a bunch of stuff before I could even get there, and I was like, well, you guys just fucked us, because like that's what the engineer is supposed to do. And that's all I was going to say, is that I think they maybe should restrict it so like soldiers can't build, because really I think that should be left to the engineer.
I mean, soldiers should just play their fucking class. I mean, at the end of the day, just play your class. Come on.
Yeah, anyway, but it's very good, and I don't know if Horde on its own is worth $60, but it's worth playing the game for. And, you know, if maybe Gears of War 4 is on sale at some point and you just want to play Horde and you just want to buy it for Horde, it's worth it. It's very, very good. Cool. And this is one scenario with a shooter where I would recommend ignore the campaign. Just jump into the new stuff. Because there's even things like this Horde mode does have the new enemy types from the campaign. Right. So that means like the robots and stuff. The robots work so much better in Horde, I don't know what the hell happened in campaign. Because in Horde, where they're just sort of the low-level enemies in, like, the first four waves or something of each, like, wave set.
Right.
I think they're actually really good, because one, they've rebalanced them so they're not completely bullet spongy. And they're kind of interesting, and it also keeps it kind of fresh. So you have waves of the robots, and you have waves of the swarm slash locust, and then you have waves where they're combined, and it works really well in Horde in a way it really doesn't in campaign, partially because campaign just keeps an iron wall between those enemy sets.
Right.
And makes it kind of boring, frankly. Huh. So, yeah, I really do feel like clearly a lot of work went into the campaign. I'm not trying to call the developers lazy. They, you know, it's not a bad game by any means. But I do feel like Horde is something where you can just feel the passion in it.
Right.
But they're the same. So the maps are really fucking good. I think I've played on most of the maps, and I've loved all of them to different degrees. Some of them I feel like are sort of more playable than others, which is always what you're going to have with this kind of mode.
Yeah.
But they're all very good and unique, and they make you play in different ways.
Are the Horde maps and the multiplayer maps still the same maps, or did they make different ones?
I'm not sure because I haven't played that much on multiplayer. I've seen a couple of Horde maps that are similar, but I do think they're a little different. Yeah, I don't think they're identical.
That was always something I found a little bit weird about Gears 2 and Gears 3 with their Horde mode, was that all the there were no like specific Horde mode maps and no specific multiplayer maps. They're all shared. And so like it always felt like a good Horde map was a good Horde map by sheer coincidence because they're all designed to be multiplayer maps by default.
No, I'm sure there might be some crossover, but from what I've seen so far, they're different. I mean, again, I played on one that's sort of a daytime map, kind of like this part of campaign where you're on sort of the settlement that Kate lives in. And I played one on multiplayer and on Horde that were similar, but the layout was different. So. Okay. I think they're unique. And the Horde maps are really well built for Horde. Like that's where I fortify. That's where the enemies come in. The maps are definitely a huge step up from Gears 2 and 3.
Cool.
Yeah. So, I don't think Gears of War 4 will be on my year-end top 10, but I will have to give it some kind of award for, like, online co-op play because Horde is so good.
Cool.
We'll get a special jury award.
Yeah. Yes. You know, that's why those awards exist, because putting things into top 10 lists is stupid.
Yes. But it's fun, stupid.
We somehow can't avoid it. It's part of us.
All right, let's do some news, Sean.
All right, let's do some news.
All right, we'll cut that out, and that'll be our official news soundbite from now on.
We've workshopped that for years now. We've been working on it since the inception of the podcast. Pretty much, it's finally there.
Took us 5 years to get there.
Yeah.
That's a lot of R&D. All right, news. First off, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 had its first kind of reveal this week in terms of actual footage and stuff. It had a poster, which was kind of fun, and then a little, like, 1.5-minute teaser trailer, and it looks like more Guardians.
Yeah, which is cool.
Which is cool. I mean, definitely it doesn't look like they somehow dropped the ball between movies 1 and 2, which is nice.
Yeah, yeah. It's because Guardians of the Galaxy, more than almost any other Marvel movie, has such a, like, unique sense of itself, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of, like, stylistically. That, yeah, like, if the sequel didn't have that, that would be...
That was my favorite thing about the really trailer. That was my favorite thing about the trailer, is that I felt like the first movie has easily the best visual style of any Marvel movie.
Yeah.
And the trailer had a lot of cool visual moments in it. Where, and I kind of like that they waited, and because we're going to talk about some other movies maybe later that have more limited scope in their trailers. Not that that's a bad thing, but I think they've been done shooting Guardians for a little while. But so they had, you know, you have Rocket and Groot in the trailer and things like that, which I think the earlier Guardians trailers really couldn't show a lot of that because they're CG characters. But it was fun. They use Hooked on a Feeling again, which is fine. Overall, it's just such a confident little tease. Marvel knows they're going to have a mega hit on their hands with this one.
Yeah.
Just based on how well the first one did, and then 2 years of word of mouth.
Yeah, like, because the Guardians of the Galaxy hit when we were both still in college, and I remember after that movie hit, I knew several people in, like, different classes and everything that had no contact with each other, that, like, I just kept on hearing people, it's like, yeah, I went to go see Guardians, like, three times in the theater, and it's like, holy shit.
No, and
people
even,
like that movie a lot.
Because like Guardians 1 was like a late August release.
Yeah.
And this is like a this is their prime slot. This is like first week of May, which is where they usually put The Avengers and Captain America Civil War.
Right.
And I think Guardians 2 could do that kind of business because I think people just loved that first movie. And if the trailers are just kind of confident and it's like, look, we're doing more of it. It's going to be fun and big and spectacular. And I think there were some good jokes in there. I liked the scene with Drax and Star-Lord.
Yeah.
It was very funny. So... it kind of made me remember how much I loved the first one, because I haven't seen it since it came out.
Yeah, me neither.
But I want to watch it again, because that was a good movie.
Yeah.
And we got another weird-ass Marvel movie coming.
Yeah, I'm really excited for Doctor Strange.
Premiered last night for... Or the embargo lifted last night for critics, and universal praise.
Yeah.
Not everyone's saying it's phenomenal, necessarily, but I've only seen, like, it's impressive in certain ways.
It's not Suicide Squad or something like that,
no.
For sure.
Yeah, so I am looking forward to Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
Which looks definitely strange in the ways it should be strange.
Yes, I want a weird psychedelic-ass movie, and based on the trailers, that's what we're getting.
Really, they should give you some kind of psychotropic drug on the way into that
movie. Yeah, I mean, they should just put in, like, the butter for the popcorn or something.
LSD butter.
Yeah, you know, hopefully they don't get it mixed up in, like, some fucking group seeing a horror movie or something doesn't get it, because that would be a very different theater experience.
I mean, this is Colorado. I feel like the Alamo Draft House, you know, they serve food.
Yeah.
They should have, like, pot brownies or something for movies
sure,
like
yeah.
Doctor Strange, right?
Yeah.
It's totally legal.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have to, like, get a license for that, but they should do that. I can totally see the Alamo doing that at some point.
Legitimately, yes, that seems like something. They might be doing that already. We don't know.
Totally. Anyway.
They didn't offer it at Shin Godzilla, but that's not that kind of movie.
No, although there are scenes where they should take the pot brownie 5 minutes before Godzilla
wakes
up.
That is a movie that if you were high seeing that movie, you wouldn't be like, oh, this is so cool. You'd be like, what the fuck is going on? I'm frightened.
You would have
like that would be triggering the paranoia side of it.
It would be a bad trip.
Yeah.
All right. So that was a good trailer. But then we had the new trailer for Assassin's Creed.
Yeah.
Which is ostensibly still coming out the same week as Rogue One.
Even though this, I don't, yeah.
This movie's probably going to get delayed to like January or something, like a death slot. These trailers are really bad. I don't know what to say.
And this one I feel like is the worst of all of them. Like,
yeah.
I made a tweet, and like I cannot believe this line is in the trailer. And I saw someone, I think it was like a comment on Reddit or something, saying that this might be true, that this line's not going to be in the movie because you didn't see whoever's saying it. It was just dubbed over. But there's a line where I think it was Jeremy Irons, right? Was that him in the trailer? He says, "We've traced your bloodline back 500 years to the Assassin's Creed." Just like, what the fuck are you talking about? Do you not know what a creed is? Like, at least the games have the fucking, like, self-respect not to say that the Assassin's Creed is the name of, like, the Assassin's Guild or whatever they are. Like, they just call themselves the Assassins. The Assassin's Creed is their creed. Like, that's a word that means something, and it's not a group of people.
Yeah, no, I think that line probably will be in the movie, because my reaction to the trailer was... They somehow made a movie out of Assassin's Creed for the subset of fans who only want to play the Animus parts.
Yeah.
Like, in the present day.
The parts of the games that they have been slowly weeding out and getting rid of since the first Assassin's Creed, when it was fucking awful.
Yeah. I mean, it's like they took everyone's least favorite part of the game and made it the movie.
Yeah.
I don't even know what an analog for that would be. It's like if they made a Gears of or a Grand Theft Auto movie where they played tennis.
Yes, they're like doing darts at the bar or bowling on
right.
a date.
Yeah.
It's just a fucking it's Grand Theft Auto 4, the movie, and it's just a dating movie. It's a romantic comedy but everyone dies at the end.
And see, that weirdly sounds more entertaining though than Assassin's Creed, the scientific like process movie.
Yeah, it's just something where this you know, I have my problems with the Assassin's Creed video game franchise, and we have talked about that a lot on this podcast, because it's a fairly long-running franchise that is...
10 years next year.
Yeah, it has had its peaks, and it has had its fucking valleys, but,
Are you excited for the Ezio collection, Sean?
Yeah, great. I want to go play the fucking Assassin's Creed 2 6 more times again or whatever, because they just kept on making that game. But, yeah, but even at its worst, I felt like at least Assassin's Creed... tries for something, you know, like there's and it's one of the reasons why I kept on going back to that franchise over and over again, even when I had my issues with it, is because it's out there and it's trying something different, and I feel like it had a sense of like you know, going for that history stuff was always really interesting to me, and just trying to be weird, and especially once they annualized it, which they did, like, after Assassin's Creed 2, so they did it very early on, and they just took this really bizarre, strange, pseudo-science fiction historical fantasy thing, and then made it an annual video game franchise, which was just impossible, and just kept on going with that, and so there's something about that I can kind of respect. The movie, like, the way they treat the fiction and everything like that in the movie, it just looks like the most Hollywood-ass video game movie I've fucking ever seen.
And it's so disappointing because this is one of the video game movies that has kind of a rare collection of talent behind it. Yeah. I mean, it stars Michael frickin' Fassbender and Marion frickin' Cotillard.
Yeah.
And Jeremy frickin' Irons, apparently.
You know, yeah,
and
Batman v Superman's Jeremy Irons.
And The Dark Knight Rises, Marion Cotillard, yeah. Who you forgot was in that movie, I bet.
Yes, I did, until you just said that.
Anyway.
Fucking Michael Fassbender could be in that movie, and I would have completely forgotten.
Anyway, it's just, it looks so boring with those actors at the center for some reason, even though I think Michael Fassbender would be the perfect guy to play an Assassin's Creed character.
Yeah.
And Marion Cotillard is perfect for kind of, she can modulate between kind of that modern woman and kind of that, you know, the assassin role they have her in, or Templar role in the past.
Yeah.
But it's like, it just, and again, maybe the movie will be better, but it also, like, the most annoying thing about this trailer to me was the pop music in it. Because, yeah. I don't know if you remember, like, the first trailer used a very good Kanye West song, but in the absolute wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie also used a perfectly decent pop song, I don't remember what it was, but in this such an annoying way where I don't know who they're pitching this movie to, because it's so into the minutiae of the Assassin's Creed game stuff, where if you have never played one of those games, you're not going to get what the fuck the trailer's talking about. But if you have played one of the games, the trailer's just kind of a turnoff, because it's like, that's the part of the games I don't want to play.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I was trying to get at with, like, the thing I respect about Assassin's Creed is that it takes its history stuff so seriously, and maybe the movie, like, the actual movie will, but by putting the fucking pop music over it in the trailers, it just makes it look so fucking goofy. And it's like, I want it to be campy in the way that it's, like, taking itself super seriously, it's really going for something. And this is just feels like they're, like, just making it campy and goofy and weird and poppy and, like, just because it's a video game movie. Like, it just looks like a video game movie instead of just being its own movie, you know?
Which, we're never going to get a hit video game movie if that's how they're treating these things.
Yeah. It's really... Because I thought early on, seeing, like, the casting news and everything like that, and thinking about Assassin's Creed as a movie, like, that could totally work if they did it the right way. And then when I heard it's like, okay, then they're not going to do a direct adaptation of one of the games. They're just going to do another story set in that universe. It's like, okay, that's absolutely the right direction to go. It's just like, it seemed like it had some potential. And maybe the movie will be good. There's always that caveat. But the trailers do not make it seem like that.
I guess I'll just go play Black Flag again. Because every time I get disappointed by Assassin's Creed, I just go play that one game I really, really love. And I'm like, okay, I can just be a pirate and I'm good with that.
Yeah.
Make another one of those. Come on.
Yeah. Also, what is it with as they've said it in all these trailers, do they think that the Assassin's Creed is, like, if it's an actual creed, it's like, because they keep on saying it of, like, we fight in the shadows to serve the light or something like that, which is, like, the most cliche, dumbass line, as opposed to the thing from the game, which is based on, like, an actual historical document, which is their, like, Assassin's Creed is nothing is true, everything is permitted, which is something that, like, obviously was, like, in Arabic or whatever, but, like, the guy who sort of started the Hashashins or whatever that the original sort of, like, group is, he actually, like, said that, like, that was, like, one of their tenets,
right?
You know, like, that's one of the things I respect about Assassin's Creed, is they do that fucking work, and that's a cool phrase. Nothing is true, everything is permitted, and it does encapsulate whatever sort of, like, minor philosophy stuff they get into the games. Put that fucking line in the trailer. That's, like, it's good enough as a line for, like, Michael Fassbender to say at the end of the trailer that sounds really cool and means practically nothing. Just go with that. Don't go with, we fight in the shadows to serve the light, like it's a fucking Underworld movie or something.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Let's rebound from that with a better movie trailer.
Okay.
And I should say I'm not going in chronological order. I kind of grouped these things more thematically. But the next one is a movie that's basically coming out the same week, which is Rogue One, A Star Wars Story.
Yes.
Which had its third and probably final trailer last week. And good God, this movie just continues to look so fucking badass good.
Yeah, the trailers for this movie are just incredible.
And, like, this one got more into the plot where we see Jyn Erso's father, played by my boy Mads Mikkelsen.
Yeah.
And he looks awesome, and apparently he was involved in kind of building the Death Star, which kind of, I think, is a cool set of stakes. And we see more of the characters, and there are so many good actors in this. And goddamn, do I already want a movie about Donnie Yen's character?
Yeah, like, that was my main takeaway from this trailer, is that there was a lot more Donnie Yen in it. And in a way that indicates that there's a lot more Donnie Yen in this movie than I thought there was going to be.
Yeah.
Based on the first couple of trailers. And that makes me fucking super happy because he's awesome. He's such a great actor.
Yeah. This movie looks great.
Yeah.
I don't even know what else to say at this point. Like, the cinematography, the music, it's all phenomenal. That shot of Darth Vader in this trailer is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, I will not be surprised if, like, this movie, like, has some of the best Darth Vader scenes in any movie. Just the way Gareth Edwards appears to kind of be shooting him.
Yeah.
And again, making him, like, scary again. Which is something we know he's good at from, like, Godzilla and stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It was exciting.
Yeah. No, like, I am definitely in that mode of where it's just, like, I just want to see the movie. And I kind of, like, I hope they don't put out another trailer because I don't want to, don't want to see anything more.
Well, that's the good thing is, even though they've done three trailers and they've been very good, I don't feel spoiled on the movie in any significant way.
It feels like each one has been very good at sort of, like, pitching the tone and the basic plot of the movie without getting into, like, the specifics of it.
And not being coy in the way maybe The Force Awakens was.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's so. Not just being like, here's a shot of Darth Vader and then like up there, here's a TIE fighter and then it's over because you saw two Star Wars things and that's all you need. It's Star Wars.
Anyway, speaking of Star Wars, I'll just rearrange these as I please.
Okay.
Yesterday, they announced officially, it's kind of funny because this didn't even have like a huge like rumor cycle. This just came out from Disney. Donald Glover of Community and of the current TV show Atlanta, and also the rapper Childish Gambino, who's very talented there too, is playing Lando Calrissian in the new in the follow up, the next Star Wars spinoff movie, which will come after Episode 8. It's the one directed by the guys who did 21 Jump Street in the Lego Movie, Phil Lord and Chris Miller, and it stars Alden Ehrenreich as young Han Solo. And goddamn, Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian is fucking great casting.
Yeah, that is really good casting for another role that is really hard to recast.
Yes, like if we can't have Donald Glover play Spider-Man, which we all wanted for a while, and now he's too old for. We can have him as Lando, and that's great.
Yes.
And I've already said, you know, Alden Ehrenreich is not nearly as well known, but I've seen him in a couple things where I can totally see why that is good casting. So this is another movie, kind of like Rogue One, where when I would hear the pitch, I'm like, that's a dumb idea for a movie, but you put enough talented people in a room, the idea doesn't so much matter. You can probably make a good movie.
It's like, you could, like, make any movie with, like, a character and just say, it's like, well, now it's a young Han Solo movie. Like, fun. Yeah. Like, as long as it's a good movie.
Yeah, and Lawrence Kasdan is writing the script. Yeah. I mean, and he's saying that's kind of going to be his Star Wars swan song, which I think is a cool thing to go back and do. So, yeah, this is a movie where I rolled my eyes when they announced it, and then they're like, and Phil Lord and Chris Miller are directing it. I'm like, okay, that's pretty smart. And then this actor I really like is playing Han Solo, and now Donald Glover's in it. And it's like, okay, this is probably going to be a fun movie.
Yeah, and then, of course, now they're going to have to make the young Lando Calrissian movie, which also young Lando Calrissian is a really great rap name.
Yes. And maybe he'll change from Childish Gambino to young Lando.
To the young Lando Calrissian.
Oh, you know what I hope they do? Do you remember in the 90s when Will Smith was in movies, and that was back when Will Smith had a rapping career, he would always do a rap song where he just did the plot of the movie in a rap.
Yeah,
in the
for
credits.
Like Men in Black and stuff like
They've got to do that for this movie.
Yes.
Where Childish Gambino just raps the plot of the young Han Solo movie.
Yes. And pitches the young Lando Calrissian pseudo-sequel.
Yes, exactly. What do they do for young Chewbacca? Is it just the same costume? Or do they do, like, he's got, like, highlights in his hair or something?
Yeah, I don't know. I like the idea of, like, a young Chewbacca movie, but it has a framing device of that it's old Chewbacca telling the story to, like, his Chewbacca grandchildren about, like, the first time he met Han Solo or whatever.
And from the whole movie has narration in Wookiee language.
And it's, like, the most successful fully subtitled movie in, like, American cinema history.
It would by default be, right? Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, that's fun. Looking forward to that. Let's talk... okay, we're going to get into video and game news in a second. A bit of TV news.
Okay.
Dragon Ball Super.
Yes.
The new Dragon Ball series that's been airing for a little over a year in Japan. They are, as of next week, at the point where it will be longer than Dragon Ball GT ever was.
Yeah.
That's crazy, right?
Yeah.
So that's coming up. But anyway, Dragon Ball Super, it has been airing for a while in Japan. For some... God only knows reason, Toei has not wanted to share it with the world.
Yeah.
Because they're stupid. And so we've all been pirating it and stuff, but finally it got an announcement that it is simulcasting on Crunchyroll, as well as Daisuke, if you have that service. But Crunchyroll is one we use and everyone in the States loves.
Yeah.
And they just put up the new episode last night, and they also have the entire Future Trunks arc, which is the current arc they're in. You can watch from the beginning of that arc right now, and they've said they're going to be adding the rest of the series in sort of 10-episode chunks. Of course, the good people at Crunchyroll need time to subtitle it.
Yeah, yeah.
But from what I've seen so far, the subtitles are very good. Maybe not, you know, every bit as polished as like what Steve Simmons has done for Funimation, but he's obviously had a lot more time.
Yeah.
But they seem good. And we finally, you can easily, legally watch Dragon Ball Super. And honestly, I have not watched much of Super just because I hate the whole process of finding fan subs and trying to get it on my TV.
Like, I just sort of like mentioned in passing last episode of the podcast that I had, like, caught up to before the front Future Trunks thing started, like the end of, they call it the Universe 6 arc, which is the first new arc, because there's the first two arcs of Dragon Ball Super are just sort of like TV versions of the two movies that came out. And so I caught up to that, and I think the Universe 6 stuff is very, very good, and I'm excited to get into the Future Trunks stuff once that arc ends, and they're pretty deep into it at this point. But yeah, I'm super happy that Dragon Ball Super is out here now in a way that it's like, I don't have to go through like trying to find a good fan subbing community or something like that and have to deal with just like, I don't like having to pirate stuff that point you have to fucking make it available in some way, because there was no other recourse other than like fucking trying to import a Blu-ray or something from Japan. So,
which cost an awful lot.
It doesn't have English subtitles if you need those. So
yeah.
That's... Yeah, like, it was a long time coming to get some form. It's weird that, like, I wonder if this had something also to do with Crunchyroll, the Funimation stuff. If, like, I assume Toei has to be doing something with Funimation for a dub at some point. Like, it would be insane if they weren't.
Well, and Funimation has the license to Dragon Ball in North America. It would have right of first refusal, I assume.
Yeah.
Like, I think Toei has to have that deal. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm just assuming that's how it has to go if there's new Dragon Ball stuff. But, yeah, I mean, this would make sense, yes, if they are simulcasting it in subs, and then at some point in the probably near future now, Funimation will start getting their dubs together, and then DVD and Blu-ray releases and all of that. But this makes sense, and I'm glad you pointed out that Funimation connection, because I'd kind of forgotten that Crunchyroll and Funimation made that deal, because this was kind of the last thing I would expect, because Toei is so famously protective of Dragon Ball.
Yeah.
They've never done anything close to a simulcast with this series.
Yeah.
And you just kind of never expected they would. I thought the closest we would get was Funimation would put out DVDs and Blu-rays, and that's how you'd have to catch up on it here. Or maybe they'd air it on Nicktoons or something. But no, it's on Crunchyroll, and you can watch it the night of, and that's pretty fucking cool.
Yeah. So. Although it's also sort of weird because Crunchyroll doesn't have Dragon Ball or Dragon Ball Z or GT, if that's your preference. But so it's like all they have, right now all they have is the Future Trunks arc for Dragon Ball Super. Eventually they'll have the whole thing up there.
Right.
But yeah.
Well, and that's such a weird thing, because I don't think Dragon Ball Z aren't streaming in their entirety anywhere in the States, right?
I think Funimation streaming service, I think they have the whole thing on there.
Okay, because I know they had tried a couple different things. It was on Hulu for a little bit, but only certain episodes.
Yeah, like Hulu had like weird select episodes. I think at some point Funimation had the whole thing up there.
Okay. Well, that's cool if they finally did that. But, I mean, I have the DVDs for all that stuff, so I don't really look for the streaming. But I know there was a long dry spell where, for some reason, that wasn't online in the States. So that's neat. But, yeah, I think this is exciting because I actually had just gotten a Crunchyroll trial and was starting to watch some stuff. And it's like, well, goddamn, I very much, if it weren't for everything else, I still have a reason to keep this.
Yeah.
And I had a reason anyway because I've been watching some Persona stuff and whatnot. But it's like, yeah.
Yeah.
And it fucking crashed the shit out of Crunchyroll yesterday. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah.
I felt kind of bad for them. Like, they've probably never had something that high profile in the moment.
Yeah, just to over be like, here for the States, yeah.
Especially because they had, like, no time to prepare because the announcement was, like, Thursday, and then it's, like, Saturday, and it's like, we're not going to be ready for that.
Yeah.
That influx. But anyway, so it's up, it's running. I streamed a little bit of it today, and it looks great. You know, way better, obviously, than fan subs or anything. So that's just really cool.
Yeah.
And it feels like a real step forward for Dragon Ball and for Toei to have it simulcasting.
Yeah, just like, you know, there are, as the last movie proved, there are a lot of very avid Dragon Ball fans over here
that deserve access
to this stuff.
And that was the weird thing, is they got Resurrection F out here basically as soon as humanly possible. It was a gargantuan hit for that niche market.
Yeah.
And then Super started, and they're like, We'll see. Which is just weird. Yeah. So anyway, but we've got it, and that's fun. And yeah, so let's go ahead and talk about some video games.
Okay.
So Persona 5 had...
Yeah, I've been playing that. It's pretty good. Yep. Yeah.
Well, they announced the English cast of the game this week.
Yes.
For like the main roles. And they also did a little like 1.5 minute trailer. They called it the protagonist trailer, although I don't think you hear a ton from the protagonist in that trailer.
Here's a spoiler. You don't hear a ton from the protagonist of the game. He is very slightly more talkative than the past protagonist in Persona games. In the sense that, like, in a couple of animated cutscenes, he says, like, two words.
Okay,
so,
nice.
There, you know, he says, like, Janna once. Yes,
yeah, right.
So, there you go.
But you basically hear him say the equivalent of that here.
Yeah.
But you hear more from the other characters. And I thought it was a fun trailer. It was cool to kind of start hearing some of these voices in English.
Yeah.
And then looking at the cast list, I think they made a good choice where it is all people new to Persona in America.
Yeah.
Basically, asterisk next to Matt Mercer, because I think he's Troy Baker's voice double, so he's done Kanji before.
Yeah, in some of the spin-off games in the anime right. version.
Yeah, so we don't have Troy Baker, but we do have his voice alike.
Yeah.
Anyway, but otherwise it's new people, and I think that's exciting, because it's easy to forget, when the Persona 3 and Persona 4 dubs were done, a lot of those people were, maybe not unknowns, but were sort of, their careers were kind of building.
And yeah, now like they were people that had done like anime dubs and stuff before, but hadn't done a lot of video games.
And now Laura Bailey and Troy Baker and people like that are the biggest stars in the gaming world, you know? And pretty much, you can throw a dart and any game is going to have them in that. So, I expect in 5 years, the Persona 5 cast will be the same way.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of fun to have new people. And I liked the voices. They sounded good. It'll probably be a really good dub. It's directed by the same guy who did the dubs of Persona 3 and 4, it sounds like. So, that's awesome. But you have actually played Persona 5
yes.
in Japanese. So, what did you think of the voices?
I thought they were good. It's one of those weird things where, you know, this is the first time for Persona... for me, where I'm coming at it from the Japanese side first, because obviously with Persona 3 and Persona 4, I played the English versions of those games, and then eventually saw like the anime or the movies that have the Japanese cast. But this is the first time I've played the game with the Japanese cast before hearing any of the English voices at all. Yeah, and I think they sound good. Obviously, it's sort of weird, like, because all that I was doing with the trailer was trying to listen to them and be like, okay, yeah, that sounds like that's Sojiro, and like that has to be the voice of Morgana based on what he's saying and stuff like that. But and so it's sort of weird trying to, like, out of context, just sort of pick up lines and figure out what characters they are and what direction they're going with. But they sound good, like they sound like kind of like they're, you know, not like copying the Japanese cast or something like that, but are sort of like similarly cast in terms of what they're doing. Like Sojiro, who's he's not one of the party members, but he's a main character. He's got a long line in the trailer, and in the Japanese version, he's got this great deep voice, and he's got a great deep voice in the English version as well. So yeah, I'm excited to get more of that. I'm really excited to get like the character trailers for some of the party members and hear more like what's Morgana's voice, because I think the two roles that are going to be really hard to nail is Morgana, and there's another character, Futaba, who in the trailers is like the kind of hacker girl. She, like, not less so for Futaba in terms of the quality of her voice, where I think Morgana's voice is very hard to sort of nail what the actress is doing. But for Futaba, since she's this like hacker girl, she talks in this really like kind of weird way. And translating that, I'm really curious to see like how they're going to do that and what she's going to talk like.
Although weirdly, I think if you look at Persona 3 and 4, sometimes that's where the dubs shine most is the hard roles. Like Igus, they just nailed so hard.
Yeah.
Or I think, I've only heard the second voice of Teddy, but that's one that really hits me hard for a character who's virtually impossible to do in English.
At least, like, Morgana does not have the thing that Teddy...
She doesn't say Neko at the end of every line?
Yeah, no, like, she does, or it would be Nya in Japanese for cats, because that's like meow.
Okay.
Like, and that's one of the main points of Morgana, is that Morgana is not a... Like Morgana looks like a mascot character and stuff like that, because it's a little, like, funny cat dude. But in actuality, Morgana's, like, kind of, with the exception of one other character, maybe the smartest, like, sort of street smartest character in the cast, and is very well spoken, and is very sort of incisive and compelling, and this very sort of contrasts Morgana's appearance.
Yeah. I liked Morgana's voice in this little trailer. There was only one or two snippets, but that one struck me, just because you've seen Morgana a lot in the marketing in Japanese, so I feel like I've seen that character a lot, and I did like that voice. I was like, I can hear that being good in the game. Obviously not a lot to go off yet, but hey, I enjoy seeing more footage from this game, and you probably enjoy getting to start to play the comparison game, and It's cool. Yeah.
I thought it was pretty funny, though, that they started with... Because it wasn't just a, like, 90-second trailer or whatever with, like, featuring the protagonist, but they also did, like, a small interview, like, video interview with the guy playing the protagonist, which I thought was, like, hey, you know, you have to say a lot of stuff as the protagonist of Persona games because you have to just yell, like, Jack Frost and, like, Pyro Jack and shit like that over and over again.
I read this on, I think, Kotaku. They said the guy who's voicing the protagonist is also the current announcer in Smash Bros.
Yeah, I heard that as well.
That is a great connection.
Yeah. So it is, but, like, it's funny to see him get interviewed and ask, like, what was your approach to this character? And, like, well, what do you think is the, sort of the qualities that the Persona 5 protagonist has? And, like, you know, as with Persona 3, Persona 4, the protagonist definitely has, like, a personality and identity that they craft very sort of skillfully around the different sort of dialogue options that they give you and stuff like that. And there's, I have a strong sense of what kind of person the Persona 5 protagonist is outside of me just sort of controlling them. But at the same time, there's not a lot of that that comes from, like, the vocal performance, you know?
Yeah.
Because he does not have a lot of lines to say.
Right.
There's a lot of, it's a lot of grunting.
All right. They also showed in this trailer the final art for the Steelbook you get for pre-ordering.
Yeah.
It looks awesome.
Yes.
I'm so excited.
Yeah.
I go to my Amazon page every day and make sure the pre-order hasn't disappeared.
Okay, that might be a bit excessive.
I'm kidding. But I do enjoy looking at it. Like, it's going to be mine in a few months. And you can brag about it because you've already played it.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about some other video game news. This is kind of a sad one. United Front Games, which is most notable as the studio that made Sleeping Dogs a few years ago, which is an excellent GTA-style open-world game, but ultimately very different.
Yeah, it's like a Hong Kong action movie open-world game.
Yeah, so where you are sort of an undercover agent in the Triad, and it's one of our favorite games of the last few years, and this studio has closed. It apparently was very sudden and a surprise.
I mean, this was really bizarre because they had, like, literally that week or whatever, maybe, like, the past week, had just put up a game called Smash and Grab on Steam Early Access. And because I had seen, like, some preview stuff of people playing it on YouTube and stuff like that, I was like, oh, this game looks kind of interesting. It was sort of a third-person action MOBA-y thing set. It looked like it was set in, like, near future, like, sort of, like, death sport thing of all these, like, gangs, like, sort of put together in an arena and forced to compete to loot, like, this, like, city or whatever. And it looked interesting, and a lot of people seemed to be really positive on it. And then, like, a week later, the studio just gets shut down out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And which I don't know what the situation is in terms of, like, the servers for that game, because it was online only. I don't know if, like, people need to go get refunds or something, but it just came completely out of nowhere.
And it's a bummer. I mean, you said this on Twitter, and I agree. We really wanted a Sleeping Dogs 2. And in fact, if there's any open world game of the last few years I would like a sequel to, I would be way more interested in a sequel to that than, frankly, even an open world sequel we're going to talk about in a few minutes here.
Sure.
Because Sleeping Dogs is such a sort of singular accomplishment in modern gaming, and it is so different and out there for what I think an action game is. And yeah, it's sad that those people are out of work.
Yeah, it was like Sleeping Dogs was in an era where there are so many open world games that just sort of like permeate the market. It felt like Sleeping Dogs had both a really unique identity with the Hong Kong action thing, but also it like brought a lot of really interesting ideas to the gameplay in terms of having this like fleshed out, interesting hand to hand combat system. In addition to like the driving and the shooting and stuff like that, that made the gameplay so much more involving than something like Grand Theft Auto 5, which, like, you know, I enjoyed Grand Theft Auto 5 quite a bit, but the gameplay part of that game wore itself out well before you finished it, you know? I felt like Sleeping Dogs was never like that.
It's
kind of one of the few open-world action games, as opposed to, like, you know, obviously open-world RPGs are a different thing, but one of the few sort of, like, open-world crime action games that didn't have that effect, that by the time I finished it, I was like, I could just go in and I could just go start more brawls in this game, because the gameplay is still fun.
Yeah, I mean, I actually wound up... I played the definitive edition of Sleeping Dogs, the remaster, so I wound up playing that game after GTA 5 came out, but by playing it afterwards, it really threw into stark relief for me my problems with GTA 5, which is that GTA 5 felt like a game from 2008. It was just a sequel to GTA 4. It didn't do anything really revolutionary. And I felt like Sleeping Dogs was something that so tried to move forward what our perception of this kind of open world game could be. Also, just like being in China and having large swaths of the game just in Chinese.
Yeah.
And things like that, that were just so different and unique, and it had a pretty compelling story and characters.
You had a button where when you were driving a car, you could just open the door of the car to get ready to jump onto, like, other cars and stuff, which is the main gameplay function. But even if you didn't that, you could just open up the door of your car and hit people on the sidewalk. Like, every open world game should allow you just to open the door of your car. It's great.
Yeah, no.
You could throw people into, like, phones and just hit them with the phone handle over and over again because they're all the environmental attacks and stuff like that. That game is fucking awesome.
That game is amazing. If you have a PS4 or Xbox One, get the Definitive Edition. I cannot recommend that game highly enough. It is phenomenal, and it is very sad. We should pour one out for United Front Games because they made at least one great game in their lifetime.
Yeah.
And I hope those people all go on to do good things.
Yeah, I hope they all land on their feet, get to keep on working in this industry.
Clearly a talented group of people. So,
yeah.
All right. Speaking of talented people, something that's actually not getting, I think, enough attention is video game voice actor strike.
Yeah, the SAG-AFTRA strike.
Yeah, SAG-AFTRA, which is the portion of SAG that is dedicated to things like voice acting, other forms of media, are on strike. This has been a long time coming because, frankly, we were just mentioning, like, 2008, like, GTA 4 started all the way back then. You know, if you think about, like, some of the actors in GTA 4, particularly the guy who played Nico, kind of complaining that there is this really big imbalance between what a game can make and what people who voice act in those games get, especially as video games get bigger and voice acting is becoming a much more notable part of games where you have full-on celebrities like Troy Baker and Laura Bailey in games.
Or Nolan North.
And, you know, they're probably doing fine for themselves. As with any strike, this really comes down to not the little people, but the people we don't know as much, who are still very hardworking and probably deserve a little bigger slice of the pie. And, so it's come on to sort of a full-blown strike, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And we'll see how that kind of bears out. It hasn't been in the news as much as I would have expected, and I'm kind of curious how it's going to resolve itself. But like I said, it's been a long time coming.
Yeah, it's something where, like, as you said, it's been in the conversation since, like, Grand Theft Auto 4, where the voice actor who played Nico sort of came out and talked about how, you know, especially, I think one of the big issues is There are several different sort of, like, arguing points that or demands that SAG-AFTRA has. Some of them are, like, basically everyone, I think, more or less agrees with that the voice actors deserve to know more about the roles they're going to play before they audition and stuff like that, which is more standard in other industries, and video game industries, like, likes to be really secret, even though they are giving the voice actors NDAs and everything like that, and they're perfectly capable of keeping industry secrets as much as anybody. They do not give them adequate information to play the roles. One of their demands is to have pay for, like, being recognized and being paid differently for motion capture work, which is not the same as voice acting work, which is becoming so much more standard in the industry, and for hazard pay and like special hours and stuff if they're doing a role that requires a lot of strenuous vocal work, like screaming, which is most of voice acting in video game is a lot of people going, ah, and like dying in a million different ways. And if you are a voice actor and that is your main occupation, if you wear out your voice doing that, then you have damaged, like, your ability to work. And so you deserve, like, special compensation for that kind of stuff. So I think those demands are reasonable. The one that, like, I still think is fine because of the way this, like, the voice acting industry in general works, but is a bit more controversial among sort of gaming fans and some gaming developers and stuff like that, and obviously among the game, like, publishers and stuff that are denying it, is that the voice actors want royalties if the game sells well enough and want, like, a very, very modest royalty on the game.
And we should note, that's the kind of thing that is completely industry standard for other forms of acting.
And for, like, voice acting in animation, for voice acting in commercials, for voice acting in movies. Like, there are standards in for voice acting in other industries that exist that the video game industry has kind of, like, skated by not really having to deal with. And it feels like at some point, SAG-AFTRA is more than well within its rights to sort of try to put it to those game publishers and say, hey, this is how the people in our union are being treated, and these are the demands that we have sort of made and are being accepted by other voice acting, like, sort of companies, like animation companies and stuff, and they're fine with it, but you are not doing this. You need to do this, and if you're not going to accede to those demands, you know, they're within their rights to go on strike.
Absolutely. I think they're very reasonable demands. I mean, again, this is part of SAG. And if you are in, you know, regular, I mean, if you're in SAG-AFTRA, you are in SAG. Yeah. But I'm just saying, if you were just a regular SAG member for, like, movies and stuff, this wouldn't even be a question. You know, that's, this is the kind of stuff you get. It should be the same for video games, especially as voice acting becomes a bigger and bigger and more varied and differentiated part of video games.
Yeah, because, you know, if for whatever reason they decided, like Naughty Dog decided to make an Uncharted 5, like you could not have someone other than Nolan North play Nathan Drake. Like, right. That's just not possible. Like, both in terms of, obviously, the vocal performance, but even the motion capture, Nolan North plays fucking Nathan Drake as much as any actor plays any role, you know?
And you could say, I mean, you could very easily put on the box, if you wanted to, Nolan North in Uncharted 4,
yeah.
Because the people who are buying Uncharted 4 know it's him, whether they know his name or not.
Yeah.
That's a selling point of that game, and it's becoming more of a selling point. Just as, you know, with any voice, just as like in movies now, in animation, you put the names of the actors on there. That's going to happen more and more in video games.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to think about it this way also. Voice acting in video games is a relatively new thing. We think of it as, oh yeah, video games have voices. But in the history of video games, that's fairly recent.
Yeah.
If you take a long relativistic view.
Especially like the more sort of high quality professional voice acting. Like if you go back to video game voice acting in like the 90s or something.
Right.
Like the original Resident Evil and that kind of stuff.
Oh, I mean,
or like the fucking English voice acting in the original Shinmu, like that is a totally different beast than what we get today.
I mean, just actually a great example of this in terms of union work is Metal Gear Solid, the first one. Those were actors in SAG-AFTRA, and because it wasn't fulfilling union-like contracts, the game itself, all the names are pseudonyms in the credits.
Right.
Like, David Hayter is not credited in Metal Gear Solid 1, something like that.
Yeah.
So it's just like, it's been a fairly, like, rocky road from the beginning to now, and this seems like probably a very necessary step. If the industry wants to have this kind of voice acting, they need to do the right thing. So,
yeah.
So, go unions?
Go voice actors. Voice actors are very unrecognized for a lot of the work they do, and they do work very hard.
Yeah.
I think like a lot of people don't have a lot of perspective on what it is like for talking into a microphone for like 5 hours a day. You know, like that. It is a lot harder work than you think. Until you try to do something like that, it's very hard to get the perspective on. Like, both what that work is like creatively, but also just sort of the physical toll it takes on people.
I know. We've been talking about going on strike from this podcast forever.
Yeah, I know. I've been sort of consulting with my agent and stuff. And I think it might be time for me to go on strike for a pay raise, you know?
Okay.
It's been too long.
We'll have to replace you with your non-union equivalent.
Yeah. I just demand hazard pay, you know?
Okay.
This is hard work. I'm throwing out my voice every week.
Yes.
It's terrible.
You could spill Diet Coke on your shirt or something?
Yeah. You know, I think I should be compensated for the Diet Coke I drink during the podcast.
Okay.
I think that's only reasonable.
All right. That's your one demand.
Troy Baker doesn't have to buy his own goddamn Diet Coke, you know?
All right. Well, let's go ahead and move on to the big three things this week, because they all happened on the same day.
Yes, they did.
Was it Wednesday or Thursday? It was like...
I don't know. It was the trailer day.
Right. There was trailer day where the trailers for Red Dead Redemption 2, Logan, the new Wolverine movie, and the Nintendo Switch, we know the name of finally, the reveal of Nintendo's NX, all happened not just in one day, but like at the same time in the morning. So there was a lot to parse and analyze. Obviously an exciting day. We're going to devote most of our time here to the Nintendo Switch, but let's go through those other two things.
Okay.
First off, Red Dead Redemption 2 was announced basically like on Twitter earlier this week where...
Yeah, they basically, Rockstar did this whole Twitter sort of hype campaign that I think ultimately the way they did this reveal sort of ended up backfiring on them when the actual trailer came out. But they started the week with like a Twitter image that was just like their logo on a red background and everyone saw that. It's like, okay, you're making Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah.
And then they, like the next day it was, oh, here's like another... like sort of similar image but zoomed out, and now you see all these like sort of silhouettes of seven cowboys on the ground. It's like, okay, yeah, you're definitely fucking making Red Dead Redemption 2. And then I think it was that the next day they've like put out an image that said Red Dead Redemption 2. It's like, I think they might be making Red Dead Redemption 2. I'm not convinced. I was pretty sure on the last one, but this one's throwing me for a loop. And then the next day
we had the trailer.
You had the trailer for Red Dead Redemption 2, which is, I think, a very good teaser trailer. But when you had already confirmed the announcement of the game with this fucking Twitter hype campaign, I think me and everyone else was expecting a where like you would at least like hear the protagonist's name or something like that, as opposed to this very sort of very beautiful and nice. And I rewatched it right before we started this podcast, and I think it's a very nice little teaser trailer that sort of sets the mood. But I think everyone, we know what the mood of Red Dead Redemption is because we played Red Dead Redemption 1. I think everyone wanted Rockstar to sort of more make a pitch for specifically what the sequel was as opposed to what Red Dead Redemption is, which is something we all know.
Why wasn't the trailer just the announcement? Like, they could have just dropped that one.
Yeah, if they had dropped that on Monday, I think everyone would be super excited about it.
They also got kind of fucked because they wound up releasing the trailer at the same time as the Nintendo Switch. Nobody talked about the Red Dead trailer that day online.
I mean, it was a weird thing where it felt like, you know, Rockstar was like, hey guys, we've got something secret to announce, and they clearly had their whole thing lined up, and then like a day later, Nintendo's like, hey, we're going to announce the Nintendo Switch on Thursday, and it's like, it just feels like Rockstar was like, oh, fuck, fuck, god damn it, you fucking assholes! Like, obviously Rockstar is like one of the most popular, famous, successful developers around, but nobody can compete with a fucking hardware announcement from Nintendo. No. Like, that's not even fair.
No. And it's almost like, I don't know, someone at Nintendo was like, when are we going to announce the new console? I'm like, well, sometime. It's like, hey, look, on Twitter, Rockstar's announcing this on Thursday. Wouldn't that be funny?
Yeah, fuck Rockstar. Fuck those guys.
Yeah.
It's like, we tried to get them to put out Grand Theft Auto V on the Wii U for years. Fuck them.
The funniest thing would have been if, like, the Nintendo Switch ad, the Mario game was Mario riding a horse.
Yeah.
Like,
it was like a bunch of, like, very clear, like, there was like Mario riding around on a horse. Then you saw like Wario like hijacking a car. Then you saw like, I don't know, Luigi getting bullied at school or something to get their bully. What other fucking games does Rockstar make? Then you have like Peach playing table tennis.
What's Max Payne in this scenario?
That Max Payne is Waluigi just getting like shot in the head very gratuitously because fuck Waluigi.
All right, sounds good. But anyway, yeah. So Red Dead Redemption 2, beautiful trailer, if a little bit of a letdown after all that hype.
Yeah.
Honestly, the biggest surprise of all of this to me is that the game is just called Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah. It felt like this just like... It was very interesting comparing it to Nintendo, which just came out with the Switch, which is a completely new sort of brand for them. And it felt like they finally learned this, like, hey, let's ditch that fucking Wii name because we thought that had a lot of sort of like brand recognition value. It clearly didn't because that was not the kind of product the Wii was. And then so they went with something different. And then Rockstar comes out and they had this brilliant naming scheme because for people who don't know, Red Dead Redemption is not the first Red Dead game. There was Red Dead Revolver, which was a sort of like third-person action game on the PS2 and stuff. Then Red Dead Redemption's obviously totally different thing, but they sort of had the license and they took the name because the name's great, and then they said, okay, that was Red Dead Revolver, this will be Red Dead Redemption. And so this is the third Red Dead game, and I think everyone was expecting it was going to be like Red Dead Revolution, Red Dead Revengeance, Red Dead blah blah blah, Red Dead Red Dead Revelations.
Red Dead Rhinoceros.
Yes, Red Dead Rhinoceros, some Red Dead or something. And because it's such a great naming scheme.
Yeah.
And then, you know, ultimately brand recognition won the day, and they're like, fuck it, it's Red Dead Redemption 2, even though it almost certainly has to be a prequel just in terms of when it's set. Who knows? I don't know if it's going to be the same characters or not, but, like, it can't be set later in the timeline than Red Dead Redemption 1, because Red Dead Redemption 1 ends in, like, 1914 or something, you know?
Right. It's about the death of the Old West.
Yeah, exactly. So Red Dead Redemption 2 is... obviously has to be set before Red Dead Redemption 1, so that's confusing for it being called 2. It's also not the second Red Dead game, it's the third Red Dead game, assholes.
And I think it's perfectly fair to call it 2, because Red Dead Revolver and Red Dead Redemption have essentially no link whatsoever.
Yeah.
But, and you know, you can make sense of like, okay, they have their Grand Theft Auto series, that's just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Clearly they're building this up, they've decided that's going to be one of their other series, and it's going to be 1, 2, on and on. But it is like, it's such an easy, you could do Red Dead, something with R, it's a good naming scheme.
Red Dead Reloaded, there you go.
Red Dead Reloaded. That actually would be a pretty good one for a game coming out 7 years after the last one. But no, it's Red Dead Redemption 2. And I guess that's also weird because the word redemption like spoke to the themes of that game.
Exactly.
And I guess this could be another redemption story, but it's just, it kind of, to me, and then the trailer was very technically beautiful, but as you say, it just felt like more of Red Dead, but with nicer graphics.
Yeah.
So there's really nothing to get excited about inherent in what they've shown so far, other than Red Dead Redemption is a great game. I am excited to play more of that, but I would like some kind of pitch of 7 years later, how is this different? And that was like, it almost like that could have been a trailer for the Red Dead Redemption remaster.
Yeah, yeah, like a really nice HD remaster. Yeah, you would not be able to tell the difference.
So we'll see. I mean, I'm looking forward to it. There's things for me to be wary about with this based on some of the stuff that went down with Grand Theft Auto V. Especially them explaining how they're going to have a big online multiplayer component.
Hey, and man, GTA Online makes them fucking insane money.
It does make them insane money, but I also worry that that's... Here, like, just I'll say this. GTA Online can be fun. It's a mess on a, like, server side and getting into games and just a basic matchmaking level. And I think that stops me from really ever wanting to play it. Because my brother and I will try to get into a game. And partially because there's no main menu and there's no way to easily matchmake. It's just incredibly frustrating to play. But the other thing is, even though I have a lot of problems with the GTA 5 campaign, I would have loved at one point for them to have done more in the single player world of that game. And clearly, they are never going to do a single player DLC for any game ever again. Because they've decided online is where the money is. I would almost be surprised if we get another Grand Theft Auto narrative game.
Right, yeah.
At a certain point. I almost expect the next Grand Theft Auto will be Grand Theft Auto Online 2, and we never get GTA 6, because that's where the money is. Sort of like why Valve does not make games anymore.
Exactly, yeah. At like, they got that sweet Steam and Dota money.
Right.
And they're just riding it out.
So, you know, I expect this game to be good. I hope the online stuff doesn't overwhelm it. And it's just, I would be sad if we lived in a world where Rockstar never does something goofy like The Ballad of Gay Tony or Undead Nightmare again.
Yeah, Undead Nightmare was awesome.
Right? So, we'll see. I mean, I just hope that the right amount of work has gone into the single player campaign. And I hope the online is a technical step up from what they did with GTA 5. And really, like... works this time.
Yeah, I mean, it's something where they have, since Grand Theft Auto 4, they have been, like, working on this online stuff and, like, clearly have had this vision for a long time of what they wanted an online multiplayer version of one of their games to be. And, like, so Grand Theft Auto 4 was fun, but, like, it was so very light, it felt, like, kind of tacked on. Then Red Dead Redemption had some online multiplayer stuff that felt a little bit more, like, more fleshed out, and particularly the free roam aspect of it felt a little bit better. And then Grand Theft Auto Online is obviously the big sort of like shift on sort of like what it is, where it's like almost like a completely different game. And I'm with you, like I barely put any time into GTA Online because it's such a crazy, like weird, messy thing. But the idea of them sort of iterating on that idea, because I can see the vision of it, and the vision is so beautiful of what an online version of one of those games is ideally. And I'm so fascinated by the idea of like them iterating on that and trying to, because obviously it's something that's like no other fucking game does GTA Online. Like there's like, it's not quite an MMO, it's not quite like a deathmatch game or a racing game or whatever. Like it's this really bizarre shared world thing. It's almost kind of like Destiny in some ways in that way. But yeah, I'm interested to see what their online stuff is, because they have confirmed that there's going to be a Red Dead Online component. But I'm confident that this game is going to be really good, because obviously Rockstar has multiple teams, and so the Red Dead, like the people who made Red Dead Redemption, the people who made Grand Theft Auto V are not like necessarily the same people.
Yeah.
And so I'm excited to see what that team has been working on, because Red Dead Redemption is the best Rockstar game.
Oh, easily. And
by far. Yeah,
easily. And, you know, even if this was just the same kind of thing I felt with Grand Theft Auto V, where it's the same game as last time, but nicer and bigger, I would accept that more with Red Dead than with Grand Theft Auto, partially because there's no other game like Red Dead.
Yeah, there are not a lot of cowboy games for some reason.
No, and it being in the Old West and having the horse mechanics and things like that just makes it so much more unique than you're in a city and you have guns.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, I hope it's more than just iterative. I hope it's really kind of a rethinking of what this game can be. But yeah, I mean, Red Dead 1 is fantastic. And, you know, I over the summer they added it to backwards compatibility on Xbox One, and I went back and just played a little bit.
Just buy the bandolier?
Oh, I have had my bandolier since we had that incident. But
but you didn't start a new game.
No, I didn't start a new game. Yeah, okay. No. I was just dicking around at the end where I'm Jack Marston instead of John, you know. And I did sacrifice someone on the altar where I do that, you know. All that crazy stuff.
I'm excited for Red Dead Redemption 2, if for nothing else than to hear you fall back into your weird serial killer like fugue.
I've been off of that for a long time, but yeah, I do think I'll fall back into it. I mean,
there's something about the lawlessness of the Old West that seems to just bring out the savage in you.
It does. I hope Red Dead Redemption 2 has some kind of trophy for like not getting the bandolier, because I would get that trophy. Damn it. Not even like, by trying.
They should put that in all games. You should always get achievements or trophies for like completely ignoring an entire mechanic of the game, like going to shops and spending the fucking money you get. You fucking idiot. What did you think that you were getting money for through the entire game?
Paying bounties.
Dude, God, you're a fucking moron.
I never had money in that game because I constantly was just getting, like, I have, my bounty in that game is enormous, especially in Mexico. The entire Mexican army is on my ass in that game. Like, really, if I ever wanted to play Red Dead again, like, actually enjoy it, I would have to start a new game and not be such a maniac, because I basically, wherever I go, I have a lot of cops on my ass.
I don't even know how you accrued a bounty that high when you don't have any fucking ammo, because you never bought the goddamn bandolier! What the fuck?
Man, this running joke is about as old as Red Dead Redemption, so this is like, this goes back, like, pre-this podcast to, like, our old podcast. It's crazy.
Anyway. Hey kids, if you play Red Dead Redemption, guess what? That one mission early on in the game, like mission 5 or whatever it is, when you go into the town with Bonnie and she says, oh, you can go into the shop to buy some medicine, that means you can go into the shops in the game and buy stuff, and one of them is a bandolier, which is a thing you can buy in during that mission, which doubles your ammo capacity for every single gun. It's a weird, obscure, bizarre thing. I know, the idea of going to shops and buying for items in video games, but it is a feature of Red Dead Redemption. I thought we should just put that out there again if people are coming to it new.
But just to recap for everyone, I beat Red Dead Redemption without having the bandolier, which is like the second item you get.
Yeah, so Sean, and you didn't even know it.
I had no idea.
Because you were playing in like the post-game part, and I was just sitting on the couch watching you, and I was like, how come you have like no ammo, Jonathan? What's going on? And then like I look at the character model and something's looking off. I'm like, did you never buy the fucking bandolier in this video game? Are you really that stupid?
Well, I look forward to the conversations we'll have next year, this time next year with Red Dead 2. It's supposed to come out fall 2017. It is crazy when you think about it that way. It will have been 7 years.
Yeah.
And maybe more if it gets pushed.
It will
pushed.
Have been 8 years when it gets pushed back to spring or whatever. Because Red Dead Redemption originally got pushed back and came out during spring. Because I remember when I bought it.
So, yeah, I mean, we can probably put money on Red Dead 2 will still come out before Mass Effect Andromeda.
that's never happening. Mass Effect Andromeda. If Mass Effect Andromeda will come out when we have reached the Andromeda Galaxy, and it will have been there the whole time.
Nice. It's just waiting for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I look forward to that. But let's talk about something else I am really impressed by. Which is, last week on the show, we did talk a little bit about this because they announced the new Wolverine movie, which has been shooting. I think it just finished shooting, directed again by James Mangold, who did the last Wolverine movie and lots of other good films, like 310 to Yuma, one of my favorite modern westerns.
It's a very good movie.
It's a good director. Walk the Line, which is about Johnny Cash, which has a connection to this trailer.
Yes.
We're going to talk about that in a second. But anyway, it was announced that the title of that movie is Logan. We got the poster, which was basically a plagiarized from Schindler's List for some reason. And we were kind of wondering where they were going to go with this. And then this week, on that same day, that same morning, we got the trailer for Logan. And I have to say, I have not been this just, like, surprised by a trailer in a while.
Yeah.
Because there are good X-Men movies and there are bad X-Men movies. Very rarely are there good X-Men trailers.
Yeah.
And
no, yeah.
Just based on the trailer, if this is not the best X-Men movie, I'm going to be extremely surprised.
Yeah, no, that trailer, like, it's always, you have the caveat of who knows what the actual movie is going to be like. A trailer is a different thing. But if that movie is like that trailer, holy shit, I'm really excited.
I mean, here's my number one takeaway. I said, it looks like they allowed James Mangold, who is a really good director, to just make a movie. Like an actual film. It has this really interesting visual style. It's like a futuristic Western. It's very dour and kind of just drained of life.
Sort of reminds me of like Children of Men or something like that.
Yeah, so the whole idea is that it's in the future. It's based on the loosely based on the Old Man Logan comic by Mark Miller.
Yeah.
I don't think it'll go in that same direction because that comic is fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Where Wolverine fights She-Hulk. I don't think they're doing that. But it's kind of that same idea where Wolverine is old. His healing is not working the same anymore. He's kind of sworn off violence. Mutants are dying or disappearing. And the world is just kind of, not even like post-apocalyptic, just like sad and kind of decaying.
Yeah.
And you get a really good feeling for that in this trailer. And I really love that it is Hugh Jackman and Patrick Stewart at the heart of this.
Yeah.
Because that's the heart of this series. And that's what moved me so much about Days of Future Past. Because I think he even said, that could be a great ending to the X-Men series. Because at the end of Days of Future Past, Wolverine wakes up, he's back in the school, and he and Professor X know what happened, and it's kind of like they've healed themselves as they've healed this world. And that's a really nice kind of ending that ties together all the weird you know, things the X-Men series has done. And so I think doing this one last movie with, you know, Hugh Jackman has been very clear this is his last time as Wolverine, and I'm guessing this is Patrick Stewart's last go as Professor X. And, man, it looks just emotional and powerful and interesting, and it just has this kind of aesthetic that doesn't look like any other superhero movie. They've said it's going to be R-rated, and I was kind of wondering, I don't really know what the use of that necessarily is, but then you see the trailer, like, yeah, that's going to need to be R-rated.
Yeah.
It looks good.
Yeah, no, it's just, it's such a confident trailer, you know, it has such an interesting pitch for it. Like, the one thing that's, I think this isn't a criticism necessarily, but it's just, like, it reminded me so much in specific instances of The Last of Us. Yeah. It's just, like, it's specifically the sort of the plot setup that the trailer gives you, at least, is that, like you said, mutants are sort of like dying off and disappearing, and Wolverine's powers are kind of going away or something like that, because he's getting older, he has scars, he's bleeding and stuff like that. And then Patrick Stewart, or Professor X, sort of tells Logan about, like, there is this girl, and then probably he's going to have to ferry this girl somewhere and get her somewhere and keep her safe. It's like that element of it feels very much like, you know, The Last of Us with yes. Joel and Ellie and stuff.
Children of Men is also actually a yeah. really good comparison, I think, too. And, yeah, the way Hugh Jackman looks in this, clearly if they ever make a Last of Us movie, he needs to play Joel.
Yeah, he does. He has a very Joel look. I think it's very smart of them to set this movie forward in the future because, you know, Hugh Jackman does not look the same he did in X-Men 1. And
yeah.
Wolverine is a character that's supposed to never age, which is a very hard thing to handle when you're making movies with real people playing characters. But
right. I think it looks great. And, yeah. and the big thing here was the use of the song Hurt by Johnny Cash. Well, it's by Nine Inch Nails. This is the Johnny Cash recording, which is one of the most famous Johnny Cash recordings and one of his best. It's one of my favorite song recordings yeah. ever. And I think you and I were talking about this off the air. I'm surprised that song isn't used more in trailers.
Yeah, it feels like it's such an obvious thing that, like, I can't think of any trailer I've seen that has used that song on it. And it feels like once you see it used here, and it has some nice, very specific things that, like, you know, like the word hurt specifically in relation to Wolverine, like, has a lot of connotations there that is effective. But in general, just the style of the song and how emotional it is and the way it builds up, and when you hit that chorus part and, like, the sort of the, you know, train kind of momentum of the chorus, that's a very Johnny Cash thing, is so good for editing trailers too. Because that's the part where in the trailer, once it hits the chorus and it starts editing, like, each shot on the chorus, it's like, that's where it's, like, unbelievable. It's almost something where that song is so powerful, you could probably cut anything like that and just have any image, like, sequence of images, and as long as you cut it with, like, a harsh black cut on each of those notes, it would be like, this is the most powerful emotional experience I've had in my adult life.
Yes, no, I watch the music video for Hurt if you haven't yet.
Yeah.
That's fucking powerful.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, it works so well, and I hadn't even thought of that the James Mangold connection, that he directed the Johnny Cash movie, yeah. so that actually makes sense. But yeah, I think it looks so good, and actually the title Logan makes a lot more sense with the tone they're going for
yeah.
of this stark Logan.
Yeah.
Like, I think it works. I'm suddenly, this is like the superhero movie I'm most excited for.
Yeah, especially
other than like Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yeah, especially after how well they did with that Wolverine movie set in Japan.
Yeah.
Obviously, like, it had its issues in the third act, but the most of that movie was so good and so interesting and so different that this looks like them sort of like going in that sort of same vector and then just kind of accelerating like a maniac.
Well, because I think we've talked about this. The best part of that Wolverine movie isn't even the Japan stuff. It's the first 15 minutes, which is like
yeah.
that little short film of him in a cabin, isolated, having these flashbacks to what happened with Jean Grey and all that, and making you care about Jean Grey in a way you didn't when she was alive.
Yeah.
And it looks like they've taken those 15 minutes and made a movie out of it.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I think this is going to be good.
Yeah.
I think people are going to be surprised. I'm very interested in this.
Yes.
So that comes out in March. And yeah, and I hope between this and Deadpool, maybe this teaches Fox about maybe a new kind of way to do X-Men. Because the thing about X-Men Apocalypse, which had its problems, not a great movie, obviously.
Yeah.
But it was also like, that was made at the same time as Deadpool. They had no time to react. You know, it was coming out with what it was. And I think, obviously, of the two X-Men movies from this year, Deadpool is going to be the one that influences things going forward.
Oh, yes, definitely.
And clearly it influenced Logan, not in tone, but in that you can do an R rating, you can go for a very specific aesthetic, and just go for it. You
yeah,
know?
You don't have to make a studio superhero movie every time, you know?
Yeah, and I think we're probably going to see a lot more of those. Because also, I'm guessing this is not a super high-budget movie in the way X-Men Apocalypse is or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And Deadpool certainly wasn't. So, yeah. Interesting stuff.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, we can just get a Cyclops equivalent movie that's just called Scott.
That would be so funny. Because, like, Logan is a good name for, like, this kind of title. Just Scott. Especially because I'm sure some people in the general audience know Wolverine's name is Logan. Very few, like, American filmgoers know Cyclops' name is Scott.
Most American moviegoers probably don't even remember that his name was Cyclops. They first probably remember him as that dick that shoots lasers that went out of his eyes.
Yes, exactly. So anyway, even though comic readers would know him very well.
Yeah.
So it's one of the weirder splits in comics to film adaptations. Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, all fun stuff, but the big topic this week, of course, is Nintendo, out of the blue, the evening before, said, hey, you want to know what the NX is?
Do you not give a shit about Red Dead Redemption 2? Well, great.
Yes, tomorrow morning, and like at 8 a.m. our time, they released the trailer for the Nintendo Switch. Kind of an odd hardware announcement. It's just one three-minute video. They didn't have an accompanying press conference or anything, although they did reveal some other details to press.
Yeah, there was a very short press release, and NVIDIA had a very short press release about their graphics processor they had.
But otherwise, I mean, should say up front, specs are still unknown.
Yeah.
Release date. They are committing still to March, which is interesting to me, but they haven't set a specific date or price or any of that. But this was a pretty substantial announcement in seeing the console, seeing what it does, seeing the different controller configurations, and I'll just say it up front, I'm very excited for this thing.
Yeah, I'm extremely intrigued by it. Like, it's a very, the announcement video is a very strong pitch for it, and obviously, like, as with anything Nintendo does, I have, like, a healthy amount of skepticism in terms of, there's a lot of stuff in terms of, like, how they'll handle online and things like that I want to know a lot more about before I get too excited about this, because I feel like I have been burned so bad by Nintendo in the past by getting excited by something they've announced and then sort of finding out that it's not quite what I wanted it to be. But going by this video, this is the most excited I've been about Nintendo hardware since, like, the GameCube, probably.
It's just a very smart announcement. And I guess I should say I'm coming from this as someone who has owned every Nintendo console released in my lifetime. Even if there are things that frustrate me about them, I'm a very happy owner of the 3DS and Wii U because a lot of good games come out there, and I'm glad to be able to play them. But I, too, have some of the frustrations and that we felt in recent years of just different things that Nintendo hardware has done that are frustrating, particularly on the home console side. This feels like a pretty good natural evolution of maybe the portable side, but it's mixing the two. So, but yeah, this is sort of, as a Nintendo fan, kind of the dream scenario. And even if certain things come up short, it's such an intriguing pitch. And I think the most important thing is that, especially in comparison to the Wii U, but also I think even the original Wii, this is such a clear vision for what the console is. In one three-minute video, and really in 30 seconds of that three-minute video, they get across what they want this thing to be, and there's not going to be any of the ambiguity as there was with the Wii U, you know?
Yeah.
At the very least, on a marketing standpoint, they are on such firmer ground with this thing. It's called the Nintendo Switch, and here's what it does. And I thought that video was actually very good because it went out of its way to show, here are things you can do with it. And
you can play basketball, and then when you're done playing basketball, you can go sit on the bench and then play a basketball video game.
Yes.
That's what people do.
Right. I mean, even if they're not realistic, but they got, you know, you got to see the controller configurations. You got to see what the hardware looks like. You got to see what it's like when you take it out of the dock or put it back in the dock. Like, in terms of your basic questions about how the thing looks and works in your hands and stuff like that, that's what they were very clear on, and I think that's a very good pitch. So let's talk about what the Nintendo Switch is. It is a hybrid portable home console device that the brains of it are basically in this tablet-esque thing that looks like it's maybe a 6 or 7 inch screen.
Yeah.
And on the sides of that are what they call the Joy-Con controllers, and you kind of slide them in and out, but when they're slid in, it kind of almost looks like the Wii U gamepad, although a little more, I think, ergonomic and everything.
Yeah.
But it's got all the buttons. It's got, you know, R1, R2. It's got the joysticks. It's got D-pad and buttons. And basically you can play it that way as a portable console, and all the brains of it are in that tablet. But then you can slide that into a home dock, and you just slide it in. It looks very nice and easy, and that will also charge it and whatnot. They've said that's about all they've said about the dock.
Yeah.
That's there for charging and connecting to the TV. We'll see if it does anything else. And once you slide it in, the image will then appear on your TV. At that point, you can kind of, it looks, this is what I was very happy about, is you can do to your heart's content what you want with the controllers. You can just take the Joy-Cons off and use them sort of like the Wii remote nunchuck, where they're kind of in separate hands.
Yeah.
Or you can slide them together on sort of a hub thing, and it'll be more like a traditional controller.
Or you can just buy a fucking video game controller.
Yes, there's a Pro Controller, which looks like a very nice evolution of the Wii U Pro Controller, which I think is a very nice controller. It's not the best, but this looks more... It basically looks like an Xbox controller, that kind of thing. So you can use either of those configurations, and then it'll be on your TV, and you can take it back and forth. It uses cartridges for the games. There was also... This made me laugh. There is a shot that very clearly showed a headphone jack and someone plugging it in. That was them, like, subtweeting Apple, right?
It has to be.
That was
just
why else would you have the close-up on the guy putting in the headphone jack?
Yeah, it's like, I don't get why they... Maybe this just, like, happens so late they can't manage this, but why would they... If they're willing to just say, hey, fuck you, Apple, even though we have a partnership with Apple and we're putting games on your devices, hey, fuck you, headphone jack.
Yeah.
But they're not willing to just say, hey, fuck you, where we have a cowboy game, too.
Yes.
Like, they should... They have Legend of Zelda. They should have, like, really lingered on, like, Link, like, riding through a field on a horse with, like, a very conspicuous sunset in the background or something.
Yep. So other details about the console is the Joy-Con controllers for certain games can also be... You can use sort of one with each player, and then two players can play just with those little things. Like, so they showed it for Mario Kart. Like, it's clearly not supposed to be the ideal way to play, but on the goal...
Yeah, but if you need to accelerate, turn, and, like, handbrake or whatever in Mario Kart, like, that's sufficient.
Yeah, totally. So you can do that. It's got... I love this. It's got a little kickstand. So the tablet you can just put out there. Every tablet should have that.
That's... Like, I'm not... sure if the kickstand was built into the tablet or if that was case he had on it.
It's built in because there was also... I've been reading so many details about this thing. Nintendo also put out a 3D demo of the device. And it's on there. It's built in. It's kind of like the Microsoft Surface, but instead of a whole... like it's just one little kickstand.
Okay.
So, yeah. I believe that's built in. And then in terms of games, they showed Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, which we knew would be a launch title for this. But then there were some surprises. We saw Skyrim Special Edition running on this thing. We saw a new Super Mario game that has yet to be announced. And it's a new. It's not a remaster of anything. And then several Wii U games that have been either remastered or reworked a little. They had a Mario Kart game and Splatoon.
Yeah.
Splatoon, to my knowledge, was just Splatoon. I don't think it's like a sequel. Mario Kart, that's definitely Mario Kart 8 because I've played a lot of it, but it's got some new stuff. Like, it's clearly King Boo is in there and he is not a character in Mario Kart 8.
Right.
So it's probably going to be like Mario Kart 8 Special Edition.
Yeah. Switch Edition.
Switch Edition, right. Mario Kart Switch, whatever what they'll call it. So it seems like they're going to bring some of the more successful Wii U titles and ones that are easy to port over to the Switch so you can play them there, but without just, like, I don't think that's going to be Mario Kart 9. That is Kart 8.
And then, but the most important game is, of course, NBA 2K17.
Right.
Which is ideally played after having just played actual basketball.
That's how all sports trailers do it, which is so weird.
No, because other...
I see that all the time.
No, because other fucking consoles aren't portable. Like, you don't have people playing, like, basketball on a street court in, like, New York City or something, and then just go sit down on a fucking bench and pull out their, like, console and just playing it right there.
Okay, well, anyway. We had NBA 2K17. Other details released since the trailer that have been asked. I mean, there's certain things they are not commenting on. They're not commenting on the specs, what's inside it. They're not commenting on, like, the resolution of the screen or whether it's a touch screen. We don't know that. I mean, the comment I think that was given to Kotaku was it'll have a good battery life. We'll see what that means.
Yeah. Of course, they're not going to say, oh, the battery life is shit.
Right. But anyway.
Don't expect that. Like, it's like 50 minutes?
Yeah. So most other details are not really released. We do know that NVIDIA is powering this thing. There are reports and rumors of what chip it is, but that has not been technically confirmed.
Yeah,
so
all they said is that it is a custom version of their Tegra chips, which is like, that could mean anything.
Yes, so I would not read too much in any direction off of that, is what I'm trying to say. What else am I forgetting? I mean, there's been little things here and there, but I think, they've said, you know, the brains of the device is in the tablet.
Yeah, obviously.
There could be more going on in the dock in terms of, like, resolution scaling, but for what we know, it's...
I imagine it must be doing something in the dock where, like, the resolution on the TV would look bad.
Well, yeah, unless it's just a native 1080p device. We don't know what it's running
on. I doubt it's that. I highly doubt games would be running 1080p on that tablet.
Right. Well, anyway, so we have, yeah, they said output to the TV, so that could mean, as you say, resolution scaling.
I imagine you would put something in that device so that it could boost up the resolution, minimally, so that it looks better on a TV screen.
Yeah, so the dock, then they also said the dock will charge the device, and then it's got a couple of USB ports on there. So I think that about covers what we saw. But yeah, I thought this was really exciting. We've talked, this is basically what we knew, like Eurogamer pretty much nailed this over the summer. Yeah. But I still think seeing it in person and done in a way that looks really good and well thought out was exciting to me.
Yeah.
Because I've said before, this is kind of my dream scenario, and I think for a lot of Nintendo fans, of what a Nintendo console is. Which is that it's a hybrid, kind of portable first, but you can play it in either configuration.
This is funny, I kind of like see it as like a home console first.
Okay.
Just like, because something about the portability of it looks a little bit impractical to me.
Well, it does, and you can think about it either way, because the brains are in the portable unit, but you can play it at home because it's a little bulky, as you say.
Because, well, the brains have to be in the portable unit to do this at all, or like, because you're not going to fucking stream it from the dock to, like, it's not remote play.
So anyway, but either way you look at it, you get both.
Yeah.
And what's nice about that going forward is that, you know, that's kind of Nintendo's sweet spot, in that now they can develop games for one device.
Yeah.
You can take them wherever you go. If you want to play all the Nintendo games, you only have to play or have one console. And the thing is, as someone who owns both the 3DS and Wii U, if you kind of share the portable and home, Nintendo, even in fallow periods, puts out a pretty steady stream of good games. If it's just one console and it's more successful, it's probably going to be a very steady stream of good games, even before you factor in third-party support, which looks fairly robust for launch, and we'll see how that continues.
Yeah, it did on Wii U as well.
Yeah, so anyway. But yeah, I'm very excited about this. I think my number one biggest concern going in, before we saw a trailer, was I want to know, like, controller stuff. How does that work?
Right, yeah.
And it feels like they did that side of it perfectly from what we've seen. The Joy-Cons look totally fine for portable play, and they'll be good for that. And I even like the idea of, like, they showed the guy on the plane where just slide them off, put it on the table, and then play that way. That seems totally good for portable. And then at home, you can slide them into the dock thing, or you can have a pro controller. It's going to let you play in a way that is comfortable to you, and they're not limiting you to, like, using a Wiimote or something.
Or have to use a tablet even when you're playing at home or something like that.
Exactly. You know, you can just slide it in. It looks, you know, pretty easy in how it runs. Of course, there are questions, as with any console reveal, of how everything is going to work. But taken at face value, this is pretty much exactly what I wanted, and in fact looks more impressive in a lot of ways than I maybe would have predicted.
Yeah, it's a lot sleeker of a device than what I was kind of expecting, because I think particularly both the Wii and the Wii U, to me, like, the controllers and the design of the console and stuff just are so cheap and plasticky, especially when you compare them to something like the Xbox One and the PS4, which obviously, you know, Nintendo works in a slightly different market. But also, if you compare the 3DS to the Vita, like, the 3DS, even with all, like, the awesome games it has on it, one of the main reasons I never got a 3DS is it's just cheap, plasticky feeling piece of crap. Every time I held the 3DS, I felt like I was going to snap it in my hands. It was like the Vita is this very sleek, solid device. You know, it's very ergonomically well designed, and it feels good. And the same thing with, like, the Xbox One, PS4 controllers, and the design of the consoles themselves. And, like, it feels, this at least looking at the pitch video and, like, all the stuff with the Switch here, it looks slick. It looks like the way that the Joy-Con snap into the tablet looks good and satisfying. And who knows, like, obviously that stuff's so tactile, you won't know until you have your hands on it. But at least the way they presented it in this video, like, it does not look cheap anymore to me.
It doesn't look cheap. It looks very usable. It looks very, like, you can very easily visually describe what this is to someone.
Yeah.
It's not like the Wii U, where the Wii U just confused people. Because if you weren't really into it, it looks like a peripheral. It's not clear what the gamepad is even for. Frankly, it's still not clear always what the gamepad is for.
It's for Super Mario Maker, and that's about it.
Yeah, really. Anyway, so, yeah, there's a lot of, and just, like, using the Wii U, you know, I've described the hilarious transfer process. You have to be someone who's good at that kind of thing to get any of that to work.
Yeah.
And this is not that. And I think the other thing to make clear is it's a clean break. And I said, even though I like my Wii U and I like my 3DS, this had to be a clean break. And I'm sure they will find some ways for certain kinds of backwards compatibility. They're bringing Wii U games over in some form or another, whether that's selling them again or it's a I don't know how they're exactly going to do it, but there's going to be some of them come over. The best ones, I'm sure, will also get, like, Smash Bros. Is rumored. I wouldn't be surprised if they find a way to get maybe, like, the last Mario one over. We'll see. But, although they have a new Mario game coming out, so maybe not. But, yeah, so it's got all that. It's called the Nintendo Switch. Like, clean break there. It doesn't require any of the old peripherals. You know, maybe they'll have a way to hook up a Wiimote or something to this, but that's not the main advertised function. You know, it'll have new controllers that are good gaming controllers that have everything you need.
Yeah, no weird gimmick thing that, like, they didn't show. It's like, oh, it's 3D, oh, motion controls, oh, gamepad stuff. It's like, nope, it's like...
The gimmick is much more baked into the console.
Yeah, I mean, the gimmick is that you can take the console with you, which isn't really a gimmick. It's just a feature of the device. It's not something that changes the way you play video games. It just opens up the places where you can play these video games, and that's it.
Absolutely, and I think this is something a lot of people talked about this week. That is a feature that the gaming industry has clearly wanted for a while. If you look at different attempts, like, you know, Vita Remote Play and the Wii U gamepad and the NVIDIA Shield and those sorts of things. And the problem with all of those is that you couldn't really take it with you. And Nintendo found a way to, Vice Gaming was reacting to it, and they said, the secret sauce this time is that it's in the tablet, and so it's totally seamless, theoretically. And that you just take it with you, and it's the same in your lap as it is on the TV, maybe, you know, resolution scaling, whatever. But it's still, it is the device, and that removes so many of the barriers around this kind of thing working. And, you know, I think that's going to be potentially a very successful and compelling proposition to the larger public than the Wii U was, or even, you know, things like the 3DS, which has been hugely successful, but in a, you know, it's almost like that's on sheer force at some point of the quality of the games and stuff.
Yeah, because also, like, compared to previous Nintendo portable systems, it's not doing as well as those, especially, like, in markets like in America and stuff like that, which are not, like, widely interested in a dedicated portable gaming device.
But I think they will be interested in something like this, you know, that can take back and forth, and it's just nice and easy to use that way. You know, one of the moments that got me in the video, I think it's early on, is the guy's playing Zelda, and then his dog is barking, and it's like, I'll just take the system with me. I was like, yeah, I've definitely had moments where my dog does not want to be downstairs with me playing my game, and I have to stop playing my game, and it would be perfectly nice if my dog just wants to be upstairs. I'm like, okay, I'll just take it with me and go upstairs or something. I don't know if I would take it out on a walk with my dog, because
that seems like... That is a way to either, like, have your dog run away on you, or to have your fucking Nintendo Switch get broken because you, like, you have your leash on your wrist or something, and your dog runs and just yanks it out of your hand.
Right. Oh, and it's just kind of mean to your dog. Like,
yeah, it's a dog. Who cares?
You should pay attention to your dog when you're on a walk.
It's a dog.
Fuck you. Anyway.
It's its own separate life form. It doesn't need you. It's fine on its own.
It needs me.
No, it doesn't.
Anyway.
It's fine on its own. It's a beast of the wild.
Yeah, I liked the trailer. I liked just the little ideas they gave you for all the different uses. Yes, some of those were very goofy, but they were goofy in a fun kind of marketing way.
Or, like, I just like that it's just like, here's some people in a car playing Mario Kart. Here's some people playing basketball, and then they go play basketball. You know, this is what people do when they do play video games. They do the thing in real life, and either while or immediately after doing the thing in real life, they do that exact same thing in a video game.
Exactly. I mean, it's a good... I think on a marketing level, it's very smart, because it's a good way to illustrate.
Yeah, it's a good, like, Coca-Cola commercial type of thing to do, but it's still... I think it was partially the song I did not like very much, and so because the song's really weird and goofy, and so it made all that stuff seem weird and goofy in a way to me that sort of stood out a bit more.
Yeah.
But yeah, the actual device is very intriguing, for sure.
Definitely. I mean... We'll go into questions in a minute. One of the things, talking about, like, making it a clean break, my favorite joke I've seen about this thing so far, it was either on Reddit or Twitter, I forget, but someone said, how much did Nintendo want to call this thing the S-Wii-TCH? The Switch. That would have been so funny if they had done that and they just couldn't get it out of their system.
Yeah.
Because I think I made a tweet the night beforehand of, like, what's the over-under on somehow they just call this thing, like, the Wii X? And they just haven't learned their lesson, because that was a probability.
Yeah, no, for sure.
But it's not. You know, I mean, people were like, it's cartridges, so it'll probably be backwards compatible with the 3DS. No, they're clearly very different cartridges, for one, because these are modern high-definition games. It'll be a different cartridge type.
Yeah.
I like that they're using cartridges. I think it's a good idea. But yeah, so let's get into some questions about it, I guess. I mean, the big one is some of the specs and internals. You know, they are not trying to compete with, like, the PS4 Pro. And that's going to be, this is not going to be like a 4K gaming powerhouse, because that's impossible to fit in a tablet.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the real question is it going to be powerful enough to do what it needs to do? Not is it powerful enough to directly compete with the, you know, Scorpio or something.
Yeah.
So what do you think about that?
Well, I think for me, the real question is, will it be powerful enough and easy enough for developers to port games that are on the PS4 and the Xbox One to the Switch without having to either, like, dumb it down a lot, like, technically speaking, or is, like, would that process just be difficult? With them having, like, this NVIDIA Tegra chip, hopefully that means that that will not be, like, insane, because obviously there's stuff like with the Wii and the Wii U that were very specific and weird and different, both in terms of like the technology and how they controlled the games. But my main question is this thing in any way viable for third-party developers to continually support it? Because obviously they're going to have their like sheet of developers is like, these are all people who are working game developers that are working on games for the Nintendo Switch. It's like, of course you're going to have that. You had that for the Wii, you had that for the Wii, you had that for the GameCube. It's like, but the third party on all those other consoles died out almost immediately on the Wii U, and it took a little bit different, or like on the Wii, they just like all the third parties died or went to other systems, except for people who just made shitty like the $20 like mini game collections or whatever. So that's my main question in terms of the power is, I'm sure it will have more than enough power to, like, it will be at least as powerful as a Wii U, obviously. It will probably be a little bit more powerful than that, at least. I think the question is, where is that then, like, in that scale between a PS4 and the Wii U? Where does that fall, and how important will that be for third-party developers to sort of port their games?
And I guess I have a slightly different take on that, which is that the market Nintendo's aiming for anyway? I don't know. Like,
but like, do they... whether or not it's a market they're aiming for, I think it is something that adds so much extra value to their console to have, like, because if you're, you know, most people don't own multiple consoles. And so I think it's a weird strategy for Nintendo to always want to be for, like, in that position of, this is the second game console you get, you know? And I think it's something, if this was a device where if you are someone who wants to also be able to play like Call of Duty or Assassin's Creed or whatever like third party franchise on this device, like that's a huge thing to me.
Absolutely. And you know, I always have to take a step back because I am someone who owns multiple consoles. And so that wouldn't affect me. I'm getting this for the Nintendo stuff, obviously.
Exactly.
But I can see what you're saying about, you know, for the larger public viability. And I should say, I mean, I would love it if those kinds of games were on there. Because frankly, I would take a cut in graphical fidelity if I could play it on something like this where
you could take it with
you. Take it with you, yeah. I would totally, not on every game, but on certain ones, I definitely would be okay with that.
Yeah.
So... we'll see. Yeah, I would be very interested if they were able to get some support because, you know, the Skyrim thing is interesting. That is a 5-year-old game. They were running the remastered version. Who knows how technically demanding that thing is? You know, I actually think some people were making fun of them having Skyrim in there because it's a 5-year-old game. It's also Skyrim. It's like very fucking popular.
I mean, yeah, look at the commercial. Like, they're not trying to target the hardcore gaming audience necessarily with that commercial. It looks like a Coca-Cola ad, and they had like NBA and Mario Kart and Mario and Zelda. And Skyrim fits there.
They want games that people recognize and where you can easily see the value of playing it on the go.
Yeah.
Like, I actually, I probably wasn't going to get Skyrim remastered this month anyway, just because I'm busy with some other stuff. But I would totally wait to play that on the Switch because I think that could be a really fun way to play Skyrim.
Sure.
I haven't played it that way before.
Yeah. So. But that brings up another question I have, which is sort of like almost like a more philosophical question at like the heart of this thing is, because it's something I've been thinking a lot about since this was announced. Do you think that the kinds of games you want to play on a console and the kinds of games you want to play on a mobile console are the same kinds of games? Like, do you think, like, would you really want to play Skyrim, like on the plane or like wherever, like you're in the park or wherever, and like wherever you might be playing your 3DS? Would you want to play the same kind of, like, that kind of game? Would you want to play a first-person shooter or whatever, like, in that kind of setting?
Not necessarily, but the point of this thing is you can choose.
Right,
which is what I like. I like the... I really am intrigued, and I like the idea of this is a thing where I can, you know, plug it in, and maybe Skyrim is something I would primarily play at home, but if I wanted to go somewhere and I wanted to play a little Skyrim, I like that I could just do that.
Right,
but there might be other Nintendo games... like maybe a Fire Emblem or something, where I'd want to be playing it more portable. But there's also times with my 3DS where, yes, absolutely, I would love if I could just throw my 3DS to the TV because I don't want to be sitting, you know, in my chair looking at a little screen.
Yeah, there I guess my question is, do you think that do you think there's like a jack of all trades, master of none issue with that, of like that it is by being both like having to compromise some of the features that it would have as a home console to also be able to support the portable thing and sacrifice some of the stuff you want with a portable console, like the size of the thing and the battery life, which I'm sure is going to have to take a hit as compared to like if they had made it a dedicated portable only thing. Like, are you worried about that being an issue that like, or that developers will make games specifically tailored only for the home mode, and so a lot of them don't work as well on the go or something like that?
I'm not really worried about that, no. Okay. And I see what you're saying, and I think that could be an issue, but I don't know. Mostly what I am interested in this thing for is the Nintendo games. So that's right. My point of reference. So if I'm talking about like Nintendo games and Nintendo developers, first and second party and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I feel like I've seen in recent years with the 3DS and Wii U this convergence of games where they would work either way. And Nintendo has done that a little bit with like Smash Bros. Was on 3DS and Wii U and things like that. But I've also played like this year, I played Kirby Planet Robobot on the 3DS. And I talked about that game a lot. It's really good.
Yeah.
And that game is so visually ambitious and so crazy at moments. I was like, man, I really wish I could play this on the TV because this is a great portable game. But there's moments where what it's doing is so big and imaginative. This would be great on the TV. And I can imagine that kind of thing being absolutely perfect for the Switch in that you can go either way and the game will play as well as it does either place. But there's going to be strengths where you want it on the TV versus the portable.
Right.
And I've been playing Paper Mario Color Splash right now. And that's a beautiful game that looks very good on the TV. But it's also the kind of game that is sort of level driven and, you know, mission driven in a way where I could also very easily see taking it away and playing it somewhere else. And in terms of maybe non-Nintendo games that I kind of have a reference mark for is Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth from earlier this year, which was both a Vita and a PS4 game. And it was birthed in Japan as a Vita game, but you know the PS4 remaster or you know upscale or whatever looked very good and was totally playable as a console game and felt very natural there.
Yeah.
But I wound up getting both the Vita and the PS4 version and going back and forth was a really fun way to play that game. I did the same thing over the summer with Final Fantasy X. So I don't know, kind of, I'm trying to think of a scenario where there's a game where I absolutely, like, it would totally just hurt it to play any of it portable. And I personally can't necessarily think of an example of that. Like, would I want to be playing Call of Duty out on the go? Probably not. But I also don't play Call of Duty. So I don't like, I don't even really play the kinds of games where that would be a question to me. Because like, for instance, one of the questions I had about this was with Breath of the Wild.
Right.
Because we saw a bunch of that over the summer. And I was wondering, that's a console game. That is a home console game. Is there going to be, would I even want to play that portably? And I actually think, yeah. I mean, would I want to be, you know, finishing the game and watching like the last cutscene that way? No, I would probably plan to be at home for that. But that's such a big and beautiful game that I can totally see wanting to kind of take it back and forth. And that's one of the ones they show in the trailer. And I kind of felt like, yeah, I got that. And, you know, that is more of a home console one, but I'd be very happy taking it on the go. So, and, you know, there are other series that have been kind of consigned to portable for years now with Nintendo, like Fire Emblem and Pokemon. And there's no reason those inherently have to be there. And Fire Emblem has had console, you know, games. Obviously, it started on the NES. It had the GameCube one. So I am kind of interested in some of these games more breaching that gap and being, you know, now there's going to be elements that it's going to be on a big TV or it can be in HD and have that resolution. And I think it being specifically a tablet with a big screen, and it will be probably not running in natively 1080p, but it'll be a high resolution screen. This is clearly not like an SD little screen or anything.
Right, yeah.
I think that also helps bridge the gap. So is that a fair answer for all of that?
Yeah. Like, I think one of the things that made me think about that is the way that Sony originally sort of pitched the Vita and a lot of like the launch lineup games for the Vita and stuff like that is Sony pushed the Vita as being this thing where it was powerful enough to play console-style games wherever, and that's why you had like Uncharted Golden Abyss and Call of Duty Black Ops Declassified and all that kind of stuff. And I think everyone sort of realized that even like great games like Gravity Rush are designed more to be played on a console are really diminished by playing it on the go, like either by the screen quality or like the controls are not as stable when you're trying to hold the thing that as you're playing it and stuff like that. And those sorts of like complex 3D games don't work as well in that environment.
No, and that's an excellent point. And I actually think to me, that's one of the things I was relieved about with this trailer is seeing that for one, the Joy-Con controllers are much more built out than like Vita controls.
Right.
Those are actual joysticks on those things. It has the two rows of shoulder buttons, which you can't actually see very well in the trailer, but in that 3D breakdown, it does have two rows. So it's got a shoulder button and a trigger. on there. So it's got everything you need in that wise. The screen is going to be big enough. I think it would be much easier to play that kind of game on the go here. But it also has, you know, the Vita had no way to, like, just plug the Vita in and throw Gravity Rush on your TV.
Sure, yeah.
Which would alleviate a lot of that, obviously. And I mean, even with other Vita games, like, I would love to be able to kind of go back and forth on Persona 4 The Golden, because right, that's like an 80-hour game, and I don't necessarily want to play the whole thing on the Vita screen. I like the idea of, if there was, you know, a Persona 5 port or something for the Switch, you could go either way, and that's probably another game that I think would work very well in either orientation. So I think having the dedicated controllers that are more built out will help. I think it being that you can go either way, that if you've got, right, you know, a game like Gravity Rush, at that point you don't really have to choose what its identity is. It is what it is, and you can play it on your TV, and that's probably the ideal way. But if you wanted to take it away for a little bit, it's not going to harm it in the same way it would be as on the Vita. And I think the other thing is, people aren't probably going to be making games like Uncharted Golden Abyss and things like that,
right,
because you don't have to, because it's not just a portable. It is also, as you say, whether you view it as a portable console first or a home console first, hopefully it's powerful enough. You know, they're not making like the Skyrim spin-off for this that's like, right, the really shitty like Vita Skyrim or something. It's just Skyrim. And hopefully we have more stuff like that. And it's not like, you know, Assassin's Creed 6 comes out or something. What are we on? 7? I don't know.
Fucking, if you are asking me to go back, okay, to figure out what numbered Assassin's Creed we're on, I don't know, because we ditched numbers like 4 fucking Assassin's Creeds ago.
Anyway, whatever the new, it, you know, hopefully it won't be Ubisoft.
Yeah, Assassin's Creed 27.
Hopefully the next Assassin's Creed isn't like, it's this game for PS4, but on the Switch, it's the spin-off with the Assassin's little brother.
Yeah, where it's the spin-off where you play as the black character, because we always put the black characters in the spin-off games for some reason.
Boy, I hadn't realized that. Yep, that's not good.
The Vita one had whatever her name, yep, was, the black woman in like New Orleans, and then, yeah, the Freedom Cry DLC had the black guy. It's like, yeah, why is that? That's weird. That's such a weird coincidence that, like, all the main protagonists have all been white guys.
Yeah. No. So I guess that would be my answer to all of that. I think it's worth thinking about, but honestly, I really have felt in the last few years this convergence as technology on both sides gets better, where maybe that line doesn't need to be blurred in the same way. And I think maybe the problem is with how people have viewed it before, which is that, you know, with a, like an Uncharted Golden Abyss, like, we're just going to make an Uncharted game for the portable console and assume nothing's different, and that's part of the problem.
Right.
And the real maybe magic of the Switch, if it works as intended, is that nothing has to be different, because if you play it either way, you're essentially getting the same experience. Would you always be in the same attitude? That's a different view.
Right.
But it would hopefully work the same either way, which, okay, is the pitch of the console. Yeah. So that's my long answer.
All right.
Is that fair?
Yeah. No.
All right. Yeah. Yeah, I guess other questions we have is, you know, I'm curious to see what kind of storage it has.
Yeah.
Because obviously the storage would have to be mostly internal. Some people have suggested maybe there's a possibility that, you know, the port or the box, like, on your TV has USB ports. So maybe there's something, yeah, where you could hook up a hard drive, but you could only play those games when it's docked.
That seems
like a stretch.
Yeah, that would be weird. Like, because, mm-hmm, I don't think people would want to use that anyways, because it would mean, like, your save or whatever, like,
right,
or you couldn't play your game portable, like, that would be totally self-defeating of the point of the system.
Right. So, but because all of that will have to be in the, like, tablet thing, I think part of the question is how much storage even can it have?
Yeah.
Because tablets can't have, you know, a terabyte in there or something.
Oh, yeah, no.
Right? And how big will games be? Luckily, there will be cartridges that you can easily put in there, and hopefully, and I assume those will work really well, and so maybe this is a console that will more heavily rely on physical media, and I'm okay with that if that's how it has to work.
Sure.
But, yeah, that's something I'm interested in, you know, what exactly are the cartridges, how big are they going to be, that kind of thing. Not physically, but, like, how much space are they, yeah, going to hold, how big are games going to be on this thing, you know, those are questions. What
the,
else?
The online stuff is, okay, I think the biggest question for me is, will it, and like, and there's a whole lot of stuff wrapped up in that, but like, start with like, kind of going off of the storage stuff, like, how robust will the online stuff be, like, how much, like, for just, also for storage, like, patches and stuff like that, like, how big are patches going to be for games,
right,
how is it going to handle patching, how is it going to handle friends lists, how is it going to handle, like, digital downloads and all that kind of stuff, like, how is it going to handle your profile and friend and like inviting friends to games and party chat and like things like that, the kinds of features that people expect from a modern device, video game or otherwise, will the Nintendo Switch have those kinds of online features?
Exactly. And while it's definitely fair to be skeptical, Nintendo has been getting its shit together on that front.
Right.
You know, they have this new unified Nintendo Network ID, which they're using for their mobile stuff, and it's all one system. You know, I recently did this where, and I was very kind of impressed because Nintendo hasn't had something like this before, where I bought a game from their website for my 3DS, and then I went home and opened my 3DS, and it was automatically downloading, huh. That kind of thing. So they can do that now. They can do that for the 3DS and Wii. So they've gotten much better at that. You can buy things from a storefront. They're getting modern there. They have a unified login that will... And I think they're doing all this clearly in preparation for the next console. Because there's only so much of a workaround you can do with the existing hardware of the Wii U and the 3DS. And they've definitely improved the online experiences there. But as I said, there's only so much. But I do feel like a lot of the account and online stuff they've been revamping is clearly in preparation for the Switch. And I think, hopefully, the idea is, because now my account is tied to my Wii U and my 3DS, and that same login will assumedly be used for the Switch, because it's the same login I now use on mobile if I were to play Pokemon Go, or Miitomo, or Super Mario Run when that comes out, then on the Switch it'll be the same login, and then it should be able to know what my digital purchases are. And hopefully for Virtual Console, that stuff will carry over. And then, you know, really it's a question of... their functionality for, like, online gaming itself has generally been pretty good this generation. Like, Mario Kart 8 and Splatoon and stuff like that run very smoothly. There's certain problems with, like, party and chat that's a more system-level stuff. So they have to implement that. They have to get the friends list working clearly. You know, they've done away with certain things there where, like, friends' numbers have gone down. They've increased how they do street passing. So there are lots of signs that I think they're getting ready for a more robust online presence. Is it still good to maybe be skeptical and hold them to it? Yes.
Yeah.
But luckily, I mean, it's not like we're completely in the wild here with no idea of what their plans are. They have been having improvements. And I think, you know, you talked about just how sleek the Switch looks and how clearly aware they are of the need to break away. I can see that carrying over into online, especially now that it's clear that a lot of these little steps they've been taking are, I think, in preparation for the big step of this new console.
Right. So then the next, the sort of second part of that question is, because this is something they didn't show at all in that pitch video, is multimedia kind of stuff. Like, because I have seen a lot of people talking about this thing like it is a tablet, so like that it is in more the market of like it's competing, like not just with like the PlayStation or whatever, but it's also competing with the iPad and that kind of stuff. And personally, like, and so some of those questions also come up with, like, does it have a touchscreen at all? Because they haven't confirmed that they didn't show anyone touching the screen at all in the video, which obviously, like, that's a big question for multimedia stuff. Because obviously, if it does have a touchscreen, that would be almost never used for games because you couldn't use the touchscreen while you have it docked and on your TV because you have the thing in the fucking dock. But for just, like, normal, like, using apps and stuff like that, do you see this as maybe having multimedia stuff? Do you think that's important if it does or doesn't?
That's a really interesting question.
For me, that's the biggest question mark because they didn't show any of it at all. And I kind of don't know what people would be expecting with that.
Well, and it's actually kind of funny because my brother and I, when we were playing Horde the other night on Gears of War, we had a long talk about this.
Yeah.
Because that is one of the... It looks like a tablet. I don't think its main function is to be an iPad.
No.
Yeah. And I think that's the wrong way to look at it. And I actually do think it was smart in the trailer to focus on games and not multimedia.
Yeah.
There's only so much you can do in one pitch video. My guess, what I personally want from it, is I would like it to be able to stream all your video services, which there's no reason to imagine it won't.
Yeah.
You know,
that to have like your Netflix app, have hopefully a Crunchyroll app so you can watch Dragon Ball Super.
Which the Wii U has. So I think anything on the Wii U will be able to work on this, right? So I think if you have your basic video streaming, hopefully also like a robust internet browser, which the Wii U and 3DS have respective versions of, you know, something like that.
Yeah, that's obviously something that like a touchscreen would be very helpful for that.
It very much would be. We'll talk about the touchscreen in a minute. Yeah, and I think it'll do those things. And that would be very, I think, satisfying to me because I would love to have this as something that, yeah, I can take around and play my games, but that would also be a really nice thing to just stream YouTube or Netflix on.
Yeah.
And have the little, you know, you have the little, the stand and just put it there and watch your YouTube and Netflix. And at that point, you know, a touchscreen might be nice for that, but you certainly don't need it for that to work because we all watch it on our TVs, which are not touchscreens, right?
Right.
So, you know, that would be nice. Now, whether or not it does more tablet-esque stuff than that, like if it has a reader app or news or
calendars,
comments,
or things like that. Functionality, alarm clocks.
I don't think so, and frankly, I hope not. I think like that's a reach too far. It is right. a gaming thing, and I think it trying to also be a tablet at a certain point just depreciates it. Like, I think that to me is one of the big lessons of the Xbox One and its launch is it's very possible for a game system to try to be too many things.
Right.
And it has to be a game system first, and multimedia is something that should be expected and is very nice. But that multi can't be too multi. It can't be trying to do everything and plug in your TV and all this other stuff, you know, because that just gets cluttered and it needs to focus on what it is. And really, I think that's what I just described are kind of the main things people tend to use tablets and stuff for. So, you know, if you can play your Minecraft and watch because Minecraft will be on this thing.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's like, given. Minecraft is on everything. You have Minecraft installed into the fucking your shoe and you don't even know it.
Yeah.
You've made the most beautiful castle and you haven't even seen it.
But all I was going to say is that I think if you can, you know, play your Minecraft and watch your Netflix on this thing, that's what like 99% of people will require from it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't need it to be more of a tablet than that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, like, my theoretical interest in the device is mostly centered on, like, I mostly would see myself just keeping it in the dock, because I don't play games on the go very much, so my, like, I'm not personally concerned with that stuff, but I think it's interesting to think about the sort of, like, the potential wider market looking at that thing, at this thing, and I'm just curious to see how Nintendo's going to pitch it for people that aren't like us, that are obviously going to watch their, like, 3-minute pitch video and, like, sort of discuss it on our fucking podcast and all that kind of stuff. But the console market is much, much bigger than that. The handheld market's much, much bigger than that of people who are not going to see this video, have no idea that this video is even out there. And, like, when they look at this device on, like, a store shelf, are they what are they going to expect? And if it looks this much like a tablet, but it doesn't function in some of the ways one would just sort of naturally expect a tablet to function, will that be a problem?
It's a really tough question to answer, especially because the tablet market has become so weirdly diversified.
Uh-huh.
Where, like, what a Microsoft tablet is, I think, philosophically fundamentally different from what, like, an iPad is.
Yeah.
Like, because a Microsoft tablet is basically the top half of a laptop, but without the keyboard. And for me, I find that very confusing. And I think for a lot of people, that's very confusing, which is why iPads sell better.
Yeah.
But then an iPad also is this incredible multimedia thing at this point that also is a productivity device and all this other stuff. So it's tough. I think this is where I want to talk about battery life, frankly.
Right.
Because I think that's part of it is this is not going to have the battery life of an iPad or a Microsoft Surface. Yeah. And that's okay. It can't. That's just, it's not going to have a 10-hour battery life. And that's not a bad thing. If it has a 1-hour battery life, that's a bad thing. I also don't think it's going to go to that extreme.
No.
But it'll probably have a 3 to 5 hour battery life because that's what like the 3DS is. That's what the Wii U gamepad is. That's what the Vita is. Mm-hmm. I think this kind of portable device, that's pretty much what you can expect. And I think that will be fine. And I think if you view it as a gaming and light multimedia device, that's fine. But then, as you say, if people are expecting more of a tablet experience and it's more of a gaming battery life, it's kind of like if you tried to buy a gaming laptop for normal laptop productivity, it's not going to serve you that well.
Yeah.
Right?
Like your whole thing is balanced for one specific thing, but you're trying to do something else with it. Like, or like if you bought a gaming laptop and you're trying to do like a bunch of video editing on it, it's like your CPU is not going to be good enough because you've put all the money on like your GPU that your fucking editing software doesn't even use, you know?
Right.
So it's that kind of thing.
Exactly. So, you know, I think if they keep on message with this as more of a gaming thing, and, you know, the nice thing about that 3-minute trailer is I can see the 30-second TV spot version of that very clearly in my head. And I think with the name and with what it looks like, it's going to be very marketable. I think, to your point, hopefully they're going to want to keep a nice balance between people having the tablet version in ads and showing the dock and playing it on a TV and having... I think this is going to be what we're going to see, where there's probably going to be a bundle at launch, like, for instance, with the Pro Controller in there.
Yeah.
That'll be a really important thing to, I think, have in there to clearly show, okay, look, you can play games with this. That's what it is. It's not an iPad where you play everything on a touchscreen. In fact, I've been going back and forth on this. Not having a touchscreen on the thing might be smart, just to, like, differentiate it from tablets fully, you know?
And if, like, if you have the touchscreen on there, but if... it's not functional for like half the time or however long, or like for someone like me, 95% of the time I would probably be using the console. Why even put the cost of putting a touchscreen in there if like one of the key features of the console means that a touchscreen would be completely useless?
Right. And my, I've been going back and forth on this. My guess, if I had to put money on it today, is there won't be a touchscreen.
Yeah, I just feel like if there was, they would have shown someone doing like something, like picking a game icon on the screen. Like, right. I just feel like it's something. Touchscreens are so ubiquitous these days that someone not using a touchscreen in that video, like,
it
stands out like a sore thumb. Like, you're kind of watching this whole thing, kind of expecting someone to swipe something on the screen, because I've seen a billion tablet commercials. You know, that's what they do. This looks like a tablet commercial.
And Nintendo has had a touchscreen device since 2004.
Exactly, right. Yeah. Since the fucking Nintendo DS, they have been doing touchscreen stuff. So, yeah, I feel
like...
And I
think, as we're saying, it doesn't need one, yeah. First. It's just basically on a basic level, it does not require one. Maybe it would be nice when you're in tablet mode to just tap on things. But, again, that I don't feel like I'm missing something when I'm doing my PS4 or Xbox One and can't do that.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with that. And if you can maybe keep the battery life up a little bit with not having a touchscreen, and keep the cost down a little bit, and maybe even it can help with resolution and stuff because there's less stuff you're putting in there. I don't know how all that works. It's probably the smart thing. And again, I think if there was, they either would have shown it in the video or just said yes. There's no reason to play coy with something like that if it's an active feature you're going to have.
Yeah. The thing I have with that, like the main question I have is, like, obviously, we are fine with not having touchscreens because we lived our whole childhoods and a touchscreen was a weird fantasy. But for someone who's like 12 years old or 13 years old, like, I mean, Nintendo's sort of prime demographic that they really like to go at is young children, mostly. And then obviously, like, they have the nostalgia factor, but it's a very, like, family-oriented, yes. Like, kid-oriented company in the sort of the games they have. And I don't think kids understand that there are such things as screens that you can't touch. The only reason they don't touch their TV screen is because it's too fucking far away while they're sitting on the couch and watching TV.
It's really tough.
Yeah, you know? it's obviously, like, these are all, like, really tough questions to sort of figure out. Both tough for, like, Nintendo and then tough for us to sort of, like, theorize what they're going to do.
And I think we're at a point in the weeds where I don't think the touchscreen itself will determine the success or failure of this console. Oh, yeah,
no, definitely not, but it's...
But you're right. I mean, it's something that, yeah, no, kids expect a touchscreen.
And I'm just wondering, like, kids going to fucking, like, you know, dad's going to bring this home and be like, hey, like, my 8-year-old son Jimmy, like, here, this is your Nintendo Switch you got for Christmas. And he, like, loads up his new Mario game and he's, like, tapping on the screen. And he's like, Dad, nothing's happening. Nothing. And he just, like, breaks the whole thing, like, trying to tap it so hard that the thing snaps.
Well, you are absolutely right. If it doesn't have one, there will be reports on Christmas Day or like, I don't know, like, it's too far for Christmas, but, like, yeah. In March, of people returning it because the touchscreen doesn't work. But there is no touchscreen.
Yeah, or like we'll have like reports of people's dogs eating their Joy-Cons or whatever after they lost it, you know? Like,
Fault, but yeah. No, there's a lot of interesting intricacies to this thing, right?
Yeah.
So
because it's a device that we've never seen before. Like, it's trying to serve a market that we don't really know fully exists because no device that has done like this specific thing before ever.
Right. And then it's down to like, what do the boxes look like in stores for the games?
Right, yeah.
Because it's a cartridge, so you don't have to have like a Wii U or PS4 like Blu-ray box.
Yeah.
But you probably want it to look like that
so that people associate with it. Yes. Because, you know, like the GameCube didn't need big boxes either, but they've had normal size like PS2, Xbox boxes because if you had a little tiny box for your weird little tiny disc, everyone would look at that and be like, that's a game for babies. I'm not a baby.
Right. Yeah, I don't think the games will be in, like, 3DS boxes, even though that might make more sense just from a size standpoint. So, yeah, how you pitch those things is interesting. I'm kind of thinking what other questions there are. You know, I am interested to learn the specs, what the expected battery life is and stuff. To me, though, I don't necessarily care about the power as much in terms of, like, raw power, but it is kind of what you were saying before. I just want to know things can, on a basic level, work on it.
Yeah.
I don't even need it to be, like, every modern game comes out on this thing, you know? Yeah. But, you know, the basic stuff. Like, I don't necessarily expect, like, Witcher 3 to be running on this or something like that. But, as you say, maybe some of the annualized and more popular, like Red Dead 2 or something.
Yeah, but, like, it's just something where Nintendo has... It's been a long time. It's been since the GameCube, since Nintendo was in a position where their console could reasonably be expected to play the games that the other consoles on the market could play.
Right.
And so, one of the main reasons for that was there was the power, but the other main reason for that was for the Wii, you had the Wiimote and all that stuff, and then the Wii, you had the gamepad, which was obviously, you could play normal fucking Call of Duty or whatever on the gamepad, but like no developer, like no third-party developer would put out a game on the Wii U and like come up with a cool specific thing for the gamepad to use, because why put the development effort into that? This is the first time where like you look at that Pro controller or you look at the Joy-Cons like in the dock and whatever, or them separated, that is just a normal video game controller. It has the same kind of like buttons in the same places. It has like analog stick placements that are like Xbox analog stick placements. Like that is just a fucking video game controller.
The only barrier would be the power.
Exactly. Right? And so like
and the specs.
But it seems like, you know, hopefully the power is in line enough that people could make slightly, like, you know, lower resolution versions of the games, like, who knows? But it's like, if Nintendo is in that position where you could get third-party games on their device again, I think that would be kind of huge. Like, I feel like it's been so long as someone who's sort of a weird, wayward Nintendo fan like myself that loved Nintendo back in the day and then kind of drifted off when they went in another direction and kind of always been like, guys, like, I want to play Super Mario Galaxy. Like, I want to play, like, fucking Pokemon. I want to play Zelda. I want to play Metroid. I want to play your games because I like your games. I mean, I don't want to pay the money for the console to just play your Nintendo games and that's it. And, like, and deal with, like, all your weird controls and everything like that. And it feels like they have finally come back to the place where they're like, yeah, okay, yeah, video game controllers are video game controllers, and like all those weird experiments, even if like the Wii worked out financially as like a strategy for going forward for the company, clearly did not succeed. Like them having actual just video game controllers feels like maybe this is a device for me again, you know, like it's a device for people who just want to play video games the way you play video games and don't want to have to deal with waggle controls and stuff.
Exactly. So yeah, I think I, you know, generally agree with Nintendo. I think it was when they say, Reggie said this earlier, that they're not concerned with teraflops.
Sure.
You know, and it's the games. And I think the Switch is hopefully going to be a good expression of that philosophy. Hopefully it's powerful enough to still, as you say, get that other stuff on there and not be a barrier to entry for developers.
Exactly, yeah.
But everything else is in line. You know, there's nothing else inherent in this that's going to stop anyone from wanting to make a game for it, right?
Yeah.
So that's the good side. Other questions for me are, what does it do to replace the existing Nintendo lineup? Obviously, this is a replacement for the Wii U. No one's questioning that.
I mean, it doesn't even need to replace the Wii U, because the Wii U was such a failure that it's like, it's not replacing it. Like, it's just the new console. Like, it's, the Wii U just died. It died already.
Right.
A long time ago.
But the 3DS is a question mark, because it's a very different system. And while the 3DS didn't sell to the levels of, like, the DS or the Game Boy, and remember, the DS is tied with the PS2 statistically as the highest-selling console ever, so that's kind of an unfair high bar, the 3DS still has 60 million units in the world. That's a big hit.
Yeah, especially in Nintendo's home country of Japan,
yes,
which it feels like Nintendo is still sort of very focused on that market in a way that, you know, like, Sony isn't and stuff like that.
So will this also replace the 3DS? And Nintendo did give one comment on this, which is to say, no, this does not mean we're killing the 3DS. And I think what it comes down to, and someone made a really good comparison on, I think, Reddit about this, which is when the DS came out, they were very clear, this is not the next Game Boy. This is not a killer of the Game Boy Advance.
Yeah.
And for a while, it wasn't. The Game Boy Advance continued to have support. But when it became clear the DS was a hit and could kind of absorb that market, then they retired the Game Boy Advance. And I think they're going to play the same kind of wait and see.
I hope so, because for me, the thing about this console that makes me by far the most interested in it is the idea of all of the people who make Nintendo games are making it for one thing, so I only have to buy this thing. So that way, if I want to play Mario and Zelda, but I also want to play Fire Emblem and Pokemon, I don't have to get two different things and don't have to get like a 3DS and I have to get a Wii U. I can just buy one thing for it. And that's like, all of Nintendo's development power focused on one thing is very appealing. And the idea of like, well, maybe Pokemon is still just a 3DS game, that is a really sort of like troubling thought.
Well, but I think what I was saying when I say they're playing wait and see is, the Switch could bomb, you know, who knows? And then at that point, maybe you have the 3DS still there in case you want to follow up on that, and then you do the 4DS or something. My guess is the Switch will be successful.
Yeah.
Over the next year, the 3DS will fade out. You know, they don't have a lot announced for the 3DS in the future in terms of original non-like remaster games. The new Sun and Moon are the last Pokemons, or are the last games for the 3DS.
Yeah.
And that's actually very traditional for Pokemon. Pokemon takes a while to jump to the next generation, and that's always been the case. Gold and Silver came out the same month, I think, as the Game Boy Advance.
Yeah.
So that's not different. And I wouldn't say you should be afraid that they'll keep Pokemon on the 3DS just because of when Sun and Moon are coming out. Not that you were saying that, but just
anyone
was worried. I think they're probably hedging their bets just a tad, and that they're not going to announce they're stopping production of the 3DS today. But if by the end of 2017 the Switch is a really big hit, then probably it's time to say goodbye to the DS line, which for me, I have to say, that's sad for me on just one level.
Right.
Because there is no gaming console I have ever had that will be as sad for me to say goodbye to as my DS. Because I've actively been playing a DS or a 3DS since 2004.
Right.
And that's an incredible lifespan for like those 12 years are just nuts. And it's probably time for Nintendo to move in another direction, but it is kind of, for me, like slightly melancholy. No one's really missing the Wii U, because very few people have it. But I think, it'll be weird to play Nintendo games in the future not with two screens on the go. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
So
actually, that raises another interesting question, like going back to something like that, the weight of Nintendo's development arm on like this one singular platform. I'm very curious like what that will mean for those developers, like for Pokemon and Fire Emblem and stuff like that, that has traditionally been a mobile kind of thing, what that's going to be for those developers having to move to a console platform that is working with like 720p, 1080p graphics and like the kinds of expectations that market has. I'm just curious like how they're going to handle that, you know, like what the scale of those games are going to become,
right?
Those, like what's going to happen to those franchises. Because like I said, that's the thing I'm most interested in. I have been in a position for like 2 or 3 years or something at this point where I keep on every like 3 months, I look at a 3DS. I'm like, I want to play Fire Emblem and Pokemon really bad. I should get a 3DS. And I'm like, it's a little bit too much expensive. I kind of don't want to do it. And I keep on kind of like hitting that point. And if there was one Nintendo device that was like, I knew I can play Pokemon, I can play Fire Emblem, I can play Mario, and I can play Zelda all on this one thing, and it's like $300 or whatever, like that is a way more enticing proposition, you know?
No, and I totally get it. And I will just say, those specific franchises and some of the other ones that have been on the 3DS, the kind of upward graphical trajectory they've been on and the kinds of ambition they've been doing on something as technically limited as the 3DS kind of makes me wonder if they knew this was coming. And it's almost like you're priming yourself. If you look at the scale of some of the stuff in Fire Emblem Fates, and you look at the scale of some of the stuff in Pokemon, or the scale of Kirby Planet Robobot, and it's like, yes, it would be more costly, obviously, to develop for a big console, but I can also see their imaginations are going in that direction already.
Right.
And I can see very easily, you know, Fire Emblem Fates has animated cutscenes, and they're done in HD already. That's the same thing you're going to do for the Switch. And
right.
You just have to make the maps look a little nicer, you know, and that kind of thing. Sort of like, you know, this is not a perfect comparison, but like Persona 3 and 4 are games that you can totally do kind of portable at home. They're not graphically demanding. And Persona 5 is sort of the next step. And it's very impressive looking, but it's also not like, you know, a 130-gigabyte game for the PS4. And
it also took them 8 years to debut Persona 5. Like, the gap between Persona 5 and Persona 4, even if you include Catherine, it's way bigger than the gap between Persona 3 and Persona 4, because making HD games takes a lot more money, a lot more time.
Well, and that's... But that point, that's true of everyone. Like, everything's
swung
down.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, are those studios going to be able to handle that? Because some studios didn't when we made the HD Switch.
I know, and I think so. I especially think if Nintendo is backing them up, and, you know, God, Nintendo has coffers deeper than anyone in the world to make this kind of stuff work. I can see that working, and I think there are already many, many indications, some of which were proven true by this video, that Nintendo has pretty much everyone all hands on deck making stuff for the Switch.
Yeah.
That they apparently have Retro Studios down in Austin making something, whether that's a new Metroid or a new Donkey Kong. They had the... Metroid Kong. That would be the weirdest fucking crossover.
Yeah. But it's Donkey Kong from first person, and he walks around, and it's like in Donkey Kong 64 where you could get the gun.
Yeah.
It's just Metroid Prime, but you play as Donkey Kong.
And you have to explore the forest instead of like a planet?
No. You're on the planet from Metroid Prime, and you visit it like 10 years after the events of Metroid Prime.
That'd be great.
You're trying to find out where Samus went because you want to fight with her in Super Smash Brothers.
But anyway, there's also that Mario game in development, which we don't know a ton about yet, but clearly it's a 3D game.
Yeah.
And I know there's indications of other studios all, you know, they've got, like I said, pretty much all hands on deck that weren't currently making like 3DS games. They're getting ready to make games for the Switch, and I think they want this thing well supported. The trailer gives a good indication that there will be this is going to be much better supported at launch than the Wii U was. Clearly, even if it's just those five games in that trailer, that would be better than the Wii U had at launch, and frankly, than like the PS4 Xbox One had at launch. So
I just hope that like EA like re-releases Mass Effect 3 again just for the Nintendo Switch, the way they did with the Wii U, and it's only Mass Effect 3.
That'd be funny.
There's just one person who only ever buys Nintendo consoles, and it's like all they've ever played is Mass Effect 3.
But I can just imagine, like, if by the end of 2017, they're going to have a Zelda game.
Yeah.
They'll probably have that Mario game, because it's been since, what, 2013, since the last 3D Mario game came out? So they've been working on it. You could have a new Metroid game, possibly, if that's what Retro is working on.
That's dope. Metroid is not as financially successful as you want it to be, so...
I'm just saying, from a visibility standpoint for Nintendo fans, if by the end of that first year, you had new, good, non-remake installments in, like, three big series, whether it's Metroid or something else. I was just using that as an example, because it is the studio that made Metroid Prime.
Yeah.
They have making something.
I bet they're making another Donkey Kong game.
Probably. But we'll see. I mean, but even then, that's on a visibility level, if you have new games in all of those series... That's a cool thing to have, and if in addition you have some of those ports and some third-party stuff coming over, you know, by the end of 2017, if the Switch is in a really healthy place, that'll be cool. And also, you know, they also released some new trailers for Breath of the Wild alongside the NX, the Switch. Good God, they could not have a better game pitching this system than Breath of the Wild. Like, that is probably the most significant launch game for a system since Mario 64. Like... When was the last time a system launched with something of that caliber?
Oh, there's Halo on the original Xbox.
Okay, Halo on the original Xbox. Yeah, definitely.
Condemned Criminal Origins on the Xbox 360 was pretty fucking good.
Okay.
Even if not a lot of people played that game, it was pretty good.
It's not moving the consoles in the same way. But
it should have.
But, like, you know, this is not Twilight Princess launching on the Wii, which is sort of... It's the Zelda game you expect. This is clearly something that is capturing people's imaginations and attention in a way I think a launch title hasn't in a while. And part of that is that they started it as a Wii U game and they were able to transfer it.
Yeah.
But still, that's going to be a hell of a system seller.
Yeah.
So... Other questions? Oh, did you have something?
Well, I was just going to ask another question. Price. What are you thinking? Price.
Well, that was actually going to be my next question, is price and bundles. Because one of the rumors before it launched is that they'll have two bundle options, and this rumor was the price would be like $299, $399. I don't know if that's true. I do think they're going to do the bundle thing, and I hope there's a bundle that has everything you need, like the dock for the Joy-Cons, and I hope it has a Pro Controller in there so you can just buy it all at once.
I have to imagine that, like, the dock thing for the Pro Cons to turn into a normal controller, that has to be standard with every version of the console, right?
I hope so, probably. Because,
I mean, it's a fucking... It looks like it's just a piece of plastic, right?
It is. So, I think that'll be standard, so I think that'll be bundled in, but then I can imagine a higher price point having the Pro Controller, and I can imagine them bundling in Breath of the Wild with that, too.
And, like, obviously, like, we probably have a little bit more memory than the other version.
Yeah, so something like that. And I think a $299, $399 split for that, I could imagine that.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I think $399 is, like, I don't know. Like, I feel like Nintendo consoles... Because wasn't the Wii U maxed out at $350 at launch, didn't it?
I believe that was
the premium version. That's where I think them hitting that $400 price point, I think, is a bit much. There's something about Nintendo that I feel
it depends on how much is in that bundle.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, if it includes Legend of Zelda, like, then maybe I could see that hitting $400. But, yeah, a $300 price point for the console sounds like that's the reasonable spot for, like, me of, like, if this launches at... $300 or, like, fucking, if they can get it lower than that, that would be crazy.
But no,
that's where, like, for me, I would be very interested in it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to buy this either way on launch day. Yeah. That's just, that's my
You lawn. Fucking bought the Wii U. Of course you are.
Yeah, no, I'm
You're going to buy the one that actually looks like a good console.
Lots of good games on the Wii U. Anyway.
There's a difference between a console that is a good console and a console that has some good games on it.
No, I understand that. It's very true. But, I think if the base version of this was $250, that's a home run.
Yeah.
If they can get that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's possible. Like, I don't think $299 would be unreasonable for what they have.
No,
there.
No.
But, like, $250 is what the 3DS launched at back in the day, and that was a flop until they changed the price point because that was clearly too high. But I think at the portable hybrid level, if you have $250, $300, then I think people understand that and are okay with it. And then if you have a bundle at $350 or $400 and the bundle is a good value proposition, then I think we're good. I hope there's a basic version and a pro version, $100 apart. I hope the pro version has at least that controller and more memory and Breath of the Wild packaged in, because I want that day one anyway.
Yeah.
And I think if you do that and you have both of those out at $400 or below, I think you're good. As you say, if you could get it to the $250 and $350 range or $300 and $350, then I think it's going to be hard for a lot of people to say no to.
Yeah, yeah. Especially if you are under $300, like that would be like kind of insane.
Yeah,
but who knows? Yeah, because it's also something like it's really hard to speculate about the price, especially when we don't know like the power of the system and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So okay, they're working with NVIDIA. PS4 and Xbox One work with AMD?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's kind of going to be interesting. What did the Wii U and Wii use? Were they just all custom?
I'm not sure. They might have been AMD. I don't remember. Like, I don't remember what their GPU was.
And basically, all the reports are they're doing some NVIDIA stuff because NVIDIA has mobile-ready
units. Yeah, because NVIDIA has the Shield or whatever the fuck that thing is called. That is a similar sort of gaming-focused tablet device.
And another point on power that I think some people are a little too frightened of is that, you know, they're comparing it to other devices with similar NVIDIA tech inside. But those are like Android tablets that aren't specifically made for gaming in that same way.
Yeah.
And they're running Android, which is not a gaming OS. So this is not running Android. I think we can probably assume that.
It'll be
some kind of custom architecture that'll make it better for game development. Even if it was the identical chip, you'll be able to get a lot more out of it with whatever Nintendo is baking into it, and hopefully it's more robust.
I think it's like we do not have anywhere near enough information to try to be like speculating on what the specific power of the processor is, just because NVIDIA specifically said, like, it is a custom chip based on this Tegra architecture. That's all they said. Like, I read the whole fucking press release because it was one paragraph long.
Yeah. But no, I mean, to wrap up, I am really excited for this thing. The day it was announced, I was so mad they announced it at 8 in the morning because I got nothing done that day just thinking about this thing. Because it just looks exciting to me, and it looks, you know, like a new and fresh idea from Nintendo that is worth getting excited for. And yes, there are things to wonder about, but they're not the same kind of caveats as you would have with the Wii U or the Wii or something.
Yeah.
Where it looks like you're going to have to get past some annoyance to play your games. Here the real question is, I think it's going to be good. It's just how good can it get?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a good place to be in.
Yeah, for me, I basically agree with that. That obviously my position as someone who's like very hot and cold on Nintendo means like I'm very cautious about getting too excited and too optimistic for what this thing is. But like based on this trailer and the pitch and all that kind of stuff and the idea of all of Nintendo's development houses sort of like really working on one device and putting out great games on one device, like, that has me way more interested in this thing than I was before it was announced. Like, I'm coming out of this, like curious enough to be like, there is a chance that I will buy this thing at launch. Where, like, there was no fucking chance I was going to buy the Wii U at launch. Like, not even close.
I didn't buy a Wii U at launch either.
Yeah.
We shall remember. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, yeah, I think, like, it was a really great pitch video. The idea of this console is awesome. I think everyone should, as with anything, like, be cautious about getting too excited about it and wait to get more details, because obviously like members of the press and stuff like that have not had any sort of hands-on with this thing at all, but it's super excited to find out more about this thing and curious to see where it goes in the future.
Absolutely. And I'll just say, like, you know, both Sean and I have been thinking a lot as the year, end of the year is going to encroach on us here.
Yeah.
What are our top 10s going to look like for the end of the year?
Yeah.
Even in a year that has been pretty fallow for Nintendo, I'm going to have like 2 or 3 slots that are Nintendo console games.
Right.
And that's not just because I'm a Nintendo fanboy. It's just, hey, those were some of the best games of the year. And that's kind of on one system that's on its absolute last legs, the Wii U, or past its last legs, and the 3DS, which is definitely in its elder period, we can say.
Sure.
And so the idea of Nintendo maybe being back to having a unified, full front of game development with good hardware behind it, and maybe even having some third-party stuff making some stuff for it.
Making video games for video game controllers again.
Yes. That is incredibly exciting, and we should all be excited just on that basic level.
Yeah.
So that's where I kind of want to close it. We will be back next week. Maybe there will be more Switch news. Maybe not.
Maybe there will be another news week where it's just like fucking PlayStation 4 just decides, eh, fuck that pro shit. We're releasing a PlayStation 5. And then Xbox is like, well, guess what? We are going to announce our Super Mega Scorpio 5 on the same day you're announcing your normal PlayStation 5.
And it just becomes an arms race.
Exactly. And then eventually the world is just dumped and covered in electronic waste because that's where we're all going anyways.
Hey, I'm excited to explore that world as soon as next week.
I'm super happy to drown in rare earth metals.